Thank you, Jean, and welcome, everyone. This is day two of our Designing Construction Issues at Hazardous Waste Sites Virtual Symposium. This slide gives you some goals of the event. I wanted to take some time today to give you guys a little overview of DCHWS. It is a collaboration between the Society of American Military Engineers, or SAME, and the EPA. SAME Denver Metro Post and SAME Philly Post are the two posts that co-sponsor with EPA. We do a number of events throughout the year. Typically, we do two in-person symposiums and a number of webinar series, as well as some planned for in-classroom training. Just to note some of the items that have happened this year related to COVID, typically during this time, we have our in-person symposium in Denver. We had to cancel our in-person symposium in March this year in Philadelphia due to COVID, and we were able to move a large majority of the agenda to Denver, which we also planned initially to do in person. Thankfully, we were able to still pull this off virtually, but I wanted to note we have over 350 attendees, and that breakout's going to be on a separate slide. And I know a lot of you are from the East Coast, and we apologize for this being 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. on the East, but with the need to move it virtually, we really had some limitations in the time frames that we could put this event on. So in a perfect world, we would have done it in the middle of the day for both the Pacific, Mountain, Central, and East, but that wasn't the case. So we really appreciate those of you who are participating on the East Coast after hours, and we apologize and recognize that this isn't ideal for you. So as I mentioned before, this symposium has over 350 registrations. Of note, we have a large majority of federal government representatives, as well as a large majority of our AEC industry representatives. We also have a number of states, and we'll see the breakout on the next slide, and other being technology vendors, site owners, academia, those types of other attendees. So we have a great portfolio of attendees here, and a lot of people from some of the comments that we got yesterday that now have the opportunity to participate in DCHWS and these symposium-like events that probably couldn't have attended in person. So I think it's sort of a silver lining on us having to move from the in-person to virtual event. The geographic representation, as I mentioned before, were predominantly a number of states from the U.S. You can see the states in orange are the ones that are heavily represented, which, to no surprise to me, highly represent Philadelphia and Denver, where we hold our in-person events. But you can also see there's a lot of other states that typically aren't represented at our in-person events that we have here, and we're really happy to have you here. In addition to our United States representation, we also have four international attendees, so welcome to you as well. Yesterday, we had two panels, panel one and panel two. Panel one talked about bringing groundwater remedies to the finish line, focusing on technologies like phytoremediation and in-situ carbon amendments to really deal with diffuse plumes. After that, we had a second panel that talked about combination remedies and really a lot of in-situ groundwater remedies, forward thinking in terms of planning and using multiple technologies to expedite site cleanup. We're going to continue our momentum on day two with a panel on thermal treatment going first, followed by the use of modern technologies to improve design and construction activities as our second panel. Our panel format that I wanted to mention to everyone is we have a moderator and three panelists. We go back to back to back with our panelists, so they're going to do 20-minute presentations, three total for an hour. We highly recommend that you type your questions in and direct them to the specific panelists as they're presenting. Our moderators are going to be moderating the Q&A, the question queue, and then setting questions up for a facilitated 20-minute question and answer session with the panelists who will be on video to mirror some of the format that we do in our in-person symposium. So again, don't be shy. Please type your questions in as they come up so we have a great facilitated Q&A. I wanted to thank our symposium committee. In addition to EPA, Jean and myself represent EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation. We have the Philadelphia Post committee, specifically Amy Bethor, Karen Budiak, Jamie Wright and Gordon Arujo, who really helped us with a lot of the back-end logistics in getting this seminar done, as well as the Denver Metro Post, Todd Bragdon, Anita Larson, Sean Quick, and David Riott. So thank you to my Post co-sponsors. We appreciate you. In addition to our Post co-sponsors for the DCHWS series, we also have our event sponsors who are listed here. Without them, we could not have had this event put on the way that it is being put on. So thank you to all of our sponsors. With that, I'd like to turn it over to our introductory remarks speaker. Mark Hanley is a fellow and president-elect for the Society of American Military Engineers, and I'll give you a brief bio for Mark, which you can read on the slide. Mark is a senior vice president and the national accounts manager for federal programs at AECOM. He holds a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from Villanova University and a master's in civil engineering construction management from Stanford. He's a registered professional engineer, or PE. He had a distinguished 32-year career in the Navy, retiring as a Reed Admiral in the Navy's Civil Engineering Corps. Mark held executive command leadership positions in the Navy Facilities Engineering Command, NAVFAC, Commander, Navy Installations Command, U.S. Navy Seabees, and the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. So with that, Mark, I'm going to turn it over to you to lead us through the Pledge of Allegiance and some introductory remarks.
Hey, thank you very much, Kate. I appreciate the warm introduction, and again, welcome to everybody. First of all, my hat's off to Kate and Jean and EPA, as well as the Denver and the Philadelphia Post for putting all this together. And I'd actually had hoped to be in Philadelphia when the first event was canceled as being one of the speakers there as well, but I'm very glad to see that you pulled this all together as a virtual event. And again, these are trying times, but one of the things I'm amazed at the people we have throughout our federal government and throughout our Society of American Military Engineers is our ability to adapt and overcome. And this is a great example of how you've adapted and overcome for this. I'll just tell you that I think this conference is a great example of how the society and EPA, support our nation. And I think most of you know that the Society of American Military Engineers, our mission is surrounded by military readiness and national security, and really the support to our military engineers. And this particular topic means quite a bit to me personally. As a junior officer, I ran a construction office out of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and I had two projects that dealt with this type of issues that you're dealing with here, and they were the removal of underground storage tanks, about 100 tanks right on the edge of the water of Pearl Harbor, and then another 100 tanks in Midway Island, again, two historic places in our Navy. And I know that the technology and all of the different abilities to address these issues has come a long way since then. And this conference also just kind of reminds me that it's all about thought leadership, that the Society of American Military Engineers, EPA, and our industry partners all bring together to this. So first of all, I welcome you to this conference. Thanks for tuning in, even those folks on the East Coast that are a little bit later. But what I'd like to do is, again, just kind of start, as we start most of our SAME events, with a little bit of honor to our nation. So I will lead you all in the Pledge of Allegiance. Please feel free to join me at home. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Again, thank you. We do that just to kind of remind us what we're doing as we serve our nation in various different capacities in the society and again, through industry. And so, again, I welcome everybody. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to join you today across the nation, a couple of international people joining again, and have a great conference. Kate, back over to you.
Mark, thank you so much for the great opening remarks. So without further ado, let us jump into the program. So to give you guys the most technical presentations, I'm going to be brief and introduce our panel-free thermal treatment challenges and lessons learned moderator, Diana Cutt. Diana is a hydrogeologist with 33 years of experience in the environmental field. In her current position as the EPA Superfund Technology Liaison for Region 2, she coordinates scientific support from EPA's Office of Research and Development, ORD, Technical Support Centers to the Region Superfund program. She also works to encourage innovative and effective solutions for assessment and remediation of contaminated sites and collaborates with scientists from EPA, other agencies, and academia to meet the priority science needs of the Superfund program. Diana, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Kate. Can you hear me?
We hear you.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. Well, welcome everyone to the thermal remediation panel. I'm really excited to hear our three speakers today and to engage you, our audience, in the Q&A session at the end. So just to get to know you a little bit about your experience related to thermal remediation, we have two questions here. So please take the poll while I continue talking, and we'll go over the results toward the end of the session. Thermal remediation has seen some really interesting innovations in the last decade or so. For example, we're seeing promise in using thermal in complex geologic settings, such as fractured rock, and in addressing emerging contaminants. We've also seen companies expanding from offering just one type of thermal technology to including others. So this really allows us a lot more flexibility in addressing complex sites, where we might want to combine remedies, including, you know, more than one thermal approach. All right, so thank you for taking, I guess we'll leave the poll up for just another minute while I introduce our first speaker. Our first speaker is Lauren Seuss with TRS Group. Lauren has over 17 years of experience in the environmental industry. As an engineer and manager in the TRS operations and sales team, Lauren oversees in-situ thermal remediation implementation and operations. Lauren has admitted that she is a thermal remediation fanatic and is obsessed with the technology. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lauren live from New Hampshire. Go ahead, Lauren.
Thank you, Diana. That made me giggle. Well, thanks everyone for joining me today. I am going to attempt to.
So, Lauren, this is Jean. Just one quick note here. We are working on getting the correct deck up on the screen. So, if you give me 1 minute, what I'm actually going to do is show them for you. And I apologize for that, but if you can tell me when to click forward, I will click forward for you on the screen.
Okay. No problem, Jean. You all are right, amazing. So you've got all the backup plans lined up. I appreciate that.
All right. So the slide.
I'm here. Okay, perfect. So I'm going to chat with you guys about some of the recent lessons learned that we have observed at some of the sites that we've been working at over the last couple of years. So if you could advance the slides, Jean. I want to mention my key collaborators, both at TRS and also Ken Cottrell with Hydrogeologic. These are individuals who have highly attributed to the successes of the projects that I'm going to be talking about today. So it wouldn't be fair for me to talk about these projects without mentioning some of our key personnel involved. Go ahead and advance to the next one. As Diana had mentioned, there have been some big advancements with the thermal remediation technologies over the last, several years. I'm going to provide a very brief, big picture overview of some of the technologies that we work with, and then talk about how we're applying these technologies at complex sites. Hopefully arm you guys with some tools that you can use when implementing thermal remedies at your sites, and of course dive into some of our case studies. Over on the right hand side, you can see a compound 1,2-dichlorobenzene that actually in its pure form boils at 179 degrees Celsius, but as you can see here from this photograph, it's actually boiling at a lower temperature, 90, 8 degrees Celsius. So these are really powerful tools that we use to volatilize contaminants that are trapped in difficult matrices. Go ahead and advance to the next slide, Jean. So these thermal technologies, a client recently described thermal remediation strategies as being the all-in strategy. This is when you want to get all of that source out of the subsurface, out of that difficult matrix that it might be trapped in. There's really three key technologies: thermal conduction heating, electrical resistance heating, and steam-enhanced extraction. HEPA remediation is the application typically of ERH applied at a lower temperature, but these are really powerful tools that we're currently using to, again, volatilize or remove contaminants that span anywhere from energetic compounds to the more typically applied chlorinated solvent DNAPL sites, to some recent work that we've been doing attacking PFAS contamination in sources. So go ahead and advance to the next slide. So what drives thermal technology selection is really its cost effectiveness. Which of these technologies is going to be most cost efficiently applied at your site? For us, it's all about power delivery, getting the power into the matrix to reach the target temperatures that are needed for volatilization. It's also about energy density. So power is kilowatts, right? And energy is kilowatts per hour. So it's all about getting power into the subsurface to reach the specific temperatures we need to get to, and then energy density to reach your remedial goals. So we use our proprietary heat wave model in order to optimize that energy density specific to each of these individual sites. And ultimately, that model informs our technology selection. But the cost of the power delivery doesn't just stop in the planning stages. It's also used, it's a very important aspect of these projects that follows us through operations. We use technology in the field to keep an eye on that power delivery and ensure that it stays high. The graph on the right, you can see how power, its density can peak at times, and we actually use water dripping into electrodes to then make sure we apply that pressure and maximize the power delivery system during operations. So go ahead and move on to the next slide. So we deal with lots of different complexities, and we'll dive into each one of these with a little bit more detail in the upcoming slides. But existing infrastructure like utility lines or buildings, roadways, train tracks, for instance, are all really good examples of existing infrastructure that needs to be worked around. Conceptual site model, so what type of contaminant that we're dealing with, how much of that contaminant is present, and also the overall geology, the hydrogeologic setting at the site really comes into play when it comes to technology selection and implementing these thermal remedies at the site. You also want to build a monitoring program that's going to fit your project goals. Over on the right-hand side, you can see the difference between power delivery for an electrical resistance heating electrode versus a TCH heater well in one certain type of matrix. So we use modeling, again, to set up sites with specific site parameters, and then use that model to inform which of the technologies would be best suited for your site. So go ahead and move on to the next slide. So this is a good example of working around existing infrastructure. This is a site in North Carolina that was recently completed where we installed thermal remediation infrastructure below a building using high angle drilling. We also perform this type of installation, but in a horizontal drilling fashion too. So you can actually put this infrastructure in at extremely high angles to work around existing infrastructure. If high angles doesn't work, there's horizontal applications that are available out there. And always when working around sensitive infrastructure, it's very important to plan for a robust vapor recovery system to ensure that while you're heating and volatilizing those contaminants, you are also capturing them and removing them from the subsurface. So go ahead and move to the next slide. With regards to contaminant type, this is a picture of a really complex contaminant. This is energetic compounds that we used a low temperature strategy on. We simply used heat to enhance hydrolysis at temperatures that were well below steaming at this particular site. So it was a low cost solution. There was no vapor recovery treatment that was needed. It's, you know, despite it being a complex contaminant, in this particular case, there was a really simple solution that was implemented at that site. It's important to know what your target temperature is. Is it going to be the boiling point of water? Are you going to need to get to temperatures that are beyond the boiling point of water? We work with a lot of compounds that form what's called a positive heteroazeotrope. This is, I could get really geeky on these compounds, but essentially what it means is that these vapor pressures of these organic compounds are additive. So they're actually boiling at temperatures that are well below the boiling point of water when they're in the presence of water. Even though in their pure form, they're supposed to be boiling at temperatures that are far above it. So all of this data is needed in planning for a thermal remedy at a site. Go ahead and advance to the next slide. So, I also wanted to cover a little bit more detail about geology and the hydrology of the site. As I mentioned before, power delivery to the subsurface is really key. Over on the right-hand side, you see power delivered per foot of heating infrastructure in the subsurface out of various different sandstone or sedimentary rock sites that we've recently completed. So you can see here that just in using electrical resistance heating at sites, you can actually get higher power delivery to the subsurface in comparison to thermal conduction heating. That's not intuitive. This is not intuitive, and is something that we use modeling to predict what these numbers are going to look like. It's all about being able to apply different voltages to the subsurface. So if you're dealing with a very dry clay and also cleaning up a very competent rock all at the same site, though we are going to design up front for the application of different voltages to those two different geologic units. So you've got to have electrodes that are equipped to apply different voltages to those geologic units. Sometimes at sites that we deal with, we're dealing with really shallow groundwater. At sites like that, we tend to build up the subsurface, or the surface rather, and use what we call a vapor recovery plenum. Again, just a different way, a different tool to use if you're dealing with sites like this and having to apply a thermal remedy at a site. So go ahead and advance to the next slide. It's really key to develop a monitoring program that's going to fit your overall project goals. You want to monitor the performance of the system, as well as making sure that the system is in compliance with the rules that you're supposed to be following, right? So how do you judge performance? How do you judge that the system is being applied? There's lots of different ways to do that. At a site that we recently completed, we also had to monitor for deflection of railroad tracks as well. Go ahead and advance to the next slide. So now I'm going to start to talk about some of the recent case studies that we've completed, or rather are in the process of completing. This is a great example of a thermal conduction heating at a site in the northeast in region 2. This is about 28,000 cubic yards that is ultimately going to be heated. It's in the construction phase right now. We are treating D-NEPL at this site from about 65 feet below grade to 125 feet below grade, all within the VEDA zone. It's a very dense glacial till. We're dealing with lots of different boulders, and we happen to be limited to one single room inside of this manufacturing with regards to the installation of that infrastructure. So we are doing some really extreme high-angled thermal conduction heater installation as a result. Go ahead and move on to the next slide. So with regards to angling this infrastructure, this is a large application. We have about 200-foot long borings that are going into the subsurface at this site. Overall, about 4 miles of thermal conduction heating elements are being installed here. It's an enormous subsurface drilling program. There is also, remember I mentioned the target treatment interval doesn't start until 65 feet below grade. So at this site, there's going to be very long unheated sections that need to be installed and prevent there from being energy applied to the subsurface in those unheated sections. Over on the left-hand side, you could see some photographs that we collected from our R&D facility in Indianapolis. We are boosting power application in these heaters to target the deeper intervals that I described previously. Go ahead and advance to the next slide. Some additional adaptations that we made for this site. So we are drilling inside of a very active manufacturing facility that would like us to be done and over with at this site as soon as possible. So we have actually sequenced construction and operation to be overlapping so that we meet the schedule constraints associated with this project. We've also incorporated multiple different rigs inside of that one room using different types of masks to work around each other. There's been a customized ventilation system to prevent there from being heat up within the room and also some of the off-gassing from the rigs as well. But one thing that a huge adaptation for this site is the use of this DeviFlex auto-rotate tool that's described on the right-hand side. So once a borehole has been installed, this high-angle borehole has been installed at the site, we use this tool, we put that into the borehole to measure specifically how much it may have rotated given the boulders that we're interfacing within the subsurface, right? So we would expect some movement, and as a result, we're doing real-time adjustments to that design and planning for those adjustments at the next location. Go ahead and advance to the next one. So now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about one of my favorite projects we recently completed. This is also on the East Coast in Maryland. About a similar size site, about 49,000 cubic yards. This is a little bit shallower of an application from 2 feet below grade all the way down to 37 feet below grade. We were targeting clay that was encountered about 20, 25 feet below grade. And this was mainly the saturated zone, very shallow groundwater at the site. In fact, the site itself was prone to flooding. Go ahead and advance to the next one. So we had a lot of infrastructure at the site that we had to work around. We had obviously railroad tracks, CSX railroad tracks that bifurcated the system. We had a county roadway over on the west side of the system as well that needed to remain open both during construction and operation. So we used a combination of heating infrastructure in the subsurface. We used both sheet pile electrical resistant heating electrodes and vertical board electrodes. The vertical board electrodes were used underneath high voltage power lines. So we were doing a little bit of everything out here. Also, due to the flooding that the site experienced, we actually built up a vapor recovery plenum across the entire site with the exception of the roadway. This VR plenum was artificial gravel that was brought into the site to essentially add an additional six inches of vapor recovery. We encapsulated that gravel with a PVC liner, and that essentially prevented us from pulling in ambient air into our vapor recovery system. Go ahead and move on to the next slide. So here you can see the installation of the subsurface electrical resistance heating elements. On the right-hand side, you see that typical drill rig being used right underneath the high voltage power lines, also adjacent to those CSX railroad tracks. The guy on the railroad tracks is actually the CSX construction monitor, so he oversaw all work that was completed within the right-of-way. There was also use of flag people that controlled the trains, because of course CSX's main goal is to keep their railroad tracks in operation. So this remedy was implemented with real close collaboration with that stakeholder. Over on the left-hand side, you see a sheet pile being installed. We love to use sheet piles. Sheet piles offer great surface area, which means great power delivery to the subsurface. And those were used throughout the site, essentially, with the exception of getting really close to those CSX railroad tracks and underneath the power line. Go ahead and move on to the next slide. So here you're going to be able to see the vapor recovery plenum that was installed at the site. As I mentioned, we brought in an artificial fill. It was gravel that was used at this site just to build up that surface area a bit. And then we covered that gravel with a PVC liner. So our vapor recovery screens were installed all within that plenum. That's where we collected the vapors. This was a trichloroethane remediation. It also had 1,4-dichlorobenzene. So we needed to ensure that we removed those contaminants from the subsurface while we were volatilizing them using heat. Go ahead and move on to the next one. As I mentioned before, CSX was a key stakeholder for the success of this project. We used a railroad track monitoring system. It's called an automatic motion track monitoring system. It recorded the deflection of the tracks as they moved. There's hundreds of these little survey prisms that attached physically to the tracks, and a station visually inspected all of these survey prisms at a set time throughout the day. During operations, we monitored things 4 times a day. During construction, it was a bit more frequent. Go ahead and move on to the next slide. Here you can see the entire system installed at the site. So in the foreground is that east side system, and then in the background is the west side system. You've got two completely different treatment equipment setups, with the railroad tracks, of course, right smack in the middle, complicating things, but nonetheless, it got it built and operated. So let's talk about some of the data that came out of this system. If you could go ahead and move on to the next slide. Here we can see the track deflection monitoring that was recorded during operations. This is just 1 week's worth of data. I mentioned during construction and at the beginning of operations, we collected this data at a high frequency. CSX had never performed a thermal remediation technology underneath their active railroad tracks, so all eyes were on this data. The orange line shows the temperature change, the swings that occurred throughout the day, and then the blue line shows the deflection that occurred. There was a lot of deflection that was just ambient with those temperature swings. So you can see as the temperature rose, we also saw a little bit of movement of the track. So overall deflection during this particular week was limited to about 0.05 inches of movement. Go ahead and move on to the next slide. So we used some of that baseline data to come up with a plan with CSX, a plan that met their needs. We needed to stay below, well below 3 inches. My goal was to not have to do any sort of action to these tracks and stay below 3/4 of an inch. That was our goal. Go ahead and move on to the next slide. Here you can see a much larger footprint of data that was collected at the site. This is over a 1 month period. What this slide says is that there was movement up to about 1/4 of an inch during this particular month of operation. So really not a lot of movement. In fact, we never reached even 3/4 of an inch of movement of those tracks. Stayed well below the CSX threshold limits. Go ahead and move on to the next slide. So this was a guaranteed remediation. We needed to meet specific groundwater goals in order to shut the system off. We also used multiple lines of evidence while making shutdown decisions. We found ourselves in a situation where one of the wells actually dried up during application of the remedy. So we weren't able to collect a sample to prove that we had met the goals. So we used other lines of evidence as well. Go ahead and advance to the next slide. Here's ultimately what the results were of this remedy. This is trichloroethane concentrations. The blue bars represent pre-electrical resistance heating application, and then the orange bar represents after. And then that also includes the sample that we were finally able to collect from that dry groundwater well. Go ahead and move on to the next one. Here we have the results of 1,4-dichlorobenzene. It was not as much of a controlling contaminant for us at this site, but nonetheless a contaminant of concern and one that was built into our contract at this site. And so in conclusion, the last slide, just leaving you guys with some lessons learned from our perspective. Power and energy densities are really the key parameters when it comes to planning for and designing these systems. Modeling is what's driving our technology selection. Hopefully you guys feel empowered with some tools that you guys can use for implementing thermal remediation at some of your sites. There are definitely some tools that help overcome complexities. And embrace those monitoring programs. Especially when it comes to stakeholders, listen to their needs and embrace monitoring to help satisfy some of their needs in applying these projects. And that's all I've got.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Lauren. Really interesting slides. And I just want to remind everyone to please don't be shy about typing your questions into the Q&A, and we'll get to your questions at the end. So our next speaker is Stefan Gripke, and he's with Cascade Thermal. You might know him from TerraTherm, which is now part of Cascade. He is the technical director for TerraTherm's projects and is involved in front-end designs and site evaluations for their subsurface thermal designs. We're going to jump right into it. Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you, and thank you, everybody, for joining today. Yes, today basically my presentation will be focusing on challenges encountered on heavily contaminated thermal NAPL sites. So the focus of my presentation today will be more of basically recovering NAPL during thermal remedies. And if we advance to the next slide. Yes. Yeah, so the real question is, why would we focus on NAPL recovery? And the thing is that in the early days, you know, most of the thermal technologies have been around for more than 20 years. And in the early days, you know, most of us thermal vendors were focusing on, I would call them the easy sites, VOC sites, chlorinated solvents. And what's very typical for that kind of a contaminant mix is that most of the mass is coming out in the vapor phase. So typically on the CVOC site, what we see is that more than 95% to 98% ends up in the vapor phase. And in other words, we don't typically focus too much on NAPL recovery because the contaminants will volatilize and be captured by the vapor treatment system. However, for some chemical mixtures, NAPL recovery is actually fairly important, and therefore we need to consider it in our thermal design. So while geology and hydrogeology is is basically determine the best technology selection. The chemical mix typically is what governs the way, basically our extraction strategy. And therefore, you know, we have seen recently a very increased focus on sites where NAPL recovery is dominant. And that's basically why, you know, in this presentation, I'll focus on how we deal with that. So if we move on to the next slide, please. Yes. So let's first look at the governance mechanism. So for NAPL recovery, especially viscosity, is super important. So for hydrocarbons, typically what we see is a dramatic decrease in viscosity change with temperature. And that basically makes a tarry material flow very well to the extraction wells. And as long as we have a system in place that easily can capture that NAPL, flowing NAPL, then we are able to bring it to the surface. Other than that, steam displacement and steam pushing is also very important. And therefore, you know, we need to take that into account and basically be prepared for when the NAPL hits our extraction wells to get it out of the soil. So on the next slide, we do have a few. Basically, you know, I think Lauren covered the three technologies fairly well. So let's move on to the next slide. Yes. So let's focus a little bit on the physical NAPL mobilization. So this is a steam site example. So basically a site where we are injecting steam through a network of steam injection wells. And then we are recovering the condensate, the vapors, and the NAPL at a network of multi-phase extraction wells. So what this slide shows is basically at, you know, we're injecting the steam front moves towards the extraction wells. In front of its steam zone, we'll generate a condensate zone. And it's very important that that we manage that condensate zone and prevent that NAPL is accumulating there. And if it's the DNAPL we're dealing with, make sure that we don't promote downward migration in that condensate zone. As close as we get to the NAPL, or basically the multi-phase extraction portion of our remedy or our extraction wells, you know, in the steam, in the initial portion of the steam remedy, we'll see the hot water basically migrating towards the well, and eventually we'll get the full breakthrough, and we'll see all that basically condensate zone hit our extraction system. Moving on to the next slide. I will show a little lab example here. This is courtesy of Jacob Gudbjerg from the Danish Technical University, and it shows exactly what happens when steam is applied in a vapor zone. So this is partly why very seldom actually apply steam entirely in the vapor zone. We always try to apply the steam down into the groundwater aquifer, so we don't basically create a situation like that. But in this particular lab tubability study, it's obvious that basically the TCE, which is the red colored rectangle here on the left hand side of the slide, yes, exactly. We have the steam being pushed in from the left towards the right. The steam hits the PCE. The condensate is generated in front of the steam zone, and in this case, the TCE is basically mobilized downward due to the condensate generation. So this is okay if we are treating down into the groundwater aquifer, because that means we had steam down there as well that would capture it. But are we entirely in the vapor zone, we would basically just spread the contamination and end up, you know, possibly making the problem bigger than it was initially. To the right-hand side, basically, this is a cross-section, again, showing the lab setup. You see the red line represents the temperature. We have boiling point temperatures up until the condensate zone. From there, the temperature decreases, and you'll see this high TCE saturation that basically promotes downward migration if we are in the vapor zone. The next slide. on the next slide here, we'll focus a little bit on the viscosity reduction. This slide shows a few different tar, or basically hydrocarbons, all from tar and down to light oils. And what we'll see that for, especially for tar, the reduction in viscosity with temperature is huge, you know, typically looking at between 1,000 and 3,000 times. And for light oils, it's a little less, around 10 times, but still, you know, what is honey at, or you know, honey-like consistency at ambient may flow like milk at elevated temperature. So this is a very, very good mechanism, basically, to mobilize NAPL in the subsurface. On the next slide, we show a credibility study we did on the number 6 fuel oil, and that is, it's a very good way of starting out. If we have a site where we are fairly confident that NAPL recovery plays a major role, the first step would be to do this fairly easy credibility study in the lab, basically evaluating the viscosity with temperature for the NAPL collected at the site. And in this case, we're looking at a number 6 fuel oil. The viscosity and density were evaluated at 3 different temperatures, at ambient, at 50 degrees, and at 90 degrees. And what we saw for this particular mix was that the viscosity diminished from 120,000 megapascal per second and down to 93 megapascal per second. So basically a decrease corresponding to 3 orders of magnitude. So obviously at a site like this, the change in viscosity with temperature is very important. Next slide, please. Yes, the next one is actually a similar plot. This is from a credibility study we did on a Hecla oil site that was mixed with ballots. And this is just to show that sometimes the change in viscosity is not that dominant, but it's still present. In this case, we ran a turbidity study at 10, 52, and 88 degrees Celsius. And we did see a reduction in viscosity, but only from 460 to 28 megapascal per second, so roughly one order of magnitude. Another thing you will see in the plots to the right, so basically a graph here shows the viscosity on the y-axis, the LNAPL temperature on the x-axis, and then on the second y-axis we have the density, and the density is basically shown in the blue line, and that's another thing we keep track of, is the density with temperature, because for some of the DNAPL sites we evaluate and treat, basically as we heat up the site, a DNAPL may become an LNAPL and the other way around. Now, obviously that has a great impact as well on the recovery strategy. If you are geared towards and have designed a system with bottom loading pumps ready to extract DNAPL, you know, it's not super good if you're not prepared to extract LNAPL, because some of your mass basically turns into an LNAPL during the heating process. Next slide, please. Yes, so you know, the two previous examples, you know, it has been very obvious that the viscosity has decreased with temperature. This is actually an example where the viscosity first decreased and then it actually started to increase again. And this was actually from the same site at the site we looked at before, but more towards the periphery of the site. And what we saw there was a decrease in viscosity up until roughly 50 degrees. And after that, the 88 degree sample basically showed a increase in viscosity. And after getting those results back, we were basically scratching our heads, you know, what's going on here? And on the next slide, what, you know, we didn't know, but just in this particular case, there was we were looking at a plastisol system. All the individual chemicals had not been probably identified at the site. And what we found was that for this particular plastisol system, it was well known in the literature that the viscosity actually increased right around 50 degrees, which corresponded perfectly with what we actually saw in the treatability study. So, you know, and I think when we get into the more complex chemicals or chemical mixtures, you know, one thing is what we know is there, but we you know, there's more and more often, I feel like, at our sites, we know what the main contaminants are, but we don't have a full picture, especially at some of the big Superfund sites. We don't have a full picture of every single chemical. And in this case, basically, you know, we found after the treatability study that, all right, we must be looking at a plastisol system, and therefore we have to handle the heat up and the recovery accordingly. Next slide, please. Yes, and then MGP LNABLs. Same thing actually applies a little bit there. Typically, MGP LNABL does decrease with temperature, but we have also seen over and over again that if we heat the site too fast, we actually end up boiling up the VOCs in the MGP waste mix. And at that point, the MGP waste actually may increase in temperature again. So this is an example. You'll see at the temperature in this particular case, we actually did run the treatability study all the way up to 270 degrees, but we also see that at our applications at MGP sites where we only treat to 100 degrees. And basically what happens is that in the process of heating, we strip off the VOCs, and then what is left is basically becomes longer and longer chains hydrocarbons, and therefore the viscosity changes again upwards. So right now we are running MGP site, and we actually have built in a two-month period in the middle of the remedy where we maintain the temperature at right around 70 to 80 degrees Celsius to basically enhance the NAPL recovery and benefit from the fact that it's a lot easier to get mass out as a NAPL and separate it and treat it at the surface compared to having to burn it in an oxidizer or alternatively, you know, discharge it or create a bunch of IDW that needs to be taken care of afterwards. So next slide will basically slow, and if we could start the middle video real quick. Excellent. Yes, so this is actually showing three different MGP NAPLs. And as you can see here in the middle, we are dealing with a predominantly D NAPL, but actually if you look carefully, there is a L NAPL floating on top of it. And this is actually one of the cases where initially we were dealing with a D NAPL and a portion of it turned into a L NAPL during the remedy. So it almost looked like one of those lava lamps. And obviously, that makes it a little more difficult to capture the NAPL in the subsurface. If we move on to the next slide. Yes, we basically, the next couple of slides, I'll try to focus a little bit on the mobility in the well field. So now, you know, once we've heated up the subsurface and we are now ready to capture it, you know, we need to get this stuff to the surface. And the NAPL may be viscous when collected at the wellhead, but if we allow it to cool down, you know, then we are cooling it down and therefore decrease the viscosity again. And worst case, we actually end up clogging the wellfield piping system. So in certain applications, we need to heat trace the entire wellfield piping system simply to avoid clogging up the conveyance piping to the treatment system. Once we have the NAPL at the surface and at our treatment system, then actually one step back. So focusing on the pumps themselves, right? So we have two different types of pumps that we typically use for these very viscous and low viscosity chemicals. One is the traditional, what we refer to as our traditional pump. It's a pneumatic pump, and it's very robust. It has few moving parts, but the problem with it is that it's pretty much fixed in the well. So it's very difficult to capture fluctuating NAPL. We also see them come up, and basically every time we utilize these pumps, we need to have a pretty sturdy and good maintenance program in place at the site. There are also piston types pumps out there. You know, one example is the high temperature black hot pump that you see on the right hand side on the first of the two pictures. They are very good at pumping high viscosity NAPL, but the problem is that they are typically very expensive. We're looking at anywhere between $7,000 to $10,000 per pump, especially when, you know, obviously we need the high temperature version. And that sometimes that's basically prohibited for using this kind of pump across the well field. So what we often do is that we implement a slurping step. And looking at how that works, well, it's basically a stinger tube that is installed in the well. We apply a high vacuum to the stinger, and therefore we basically suck off the LNAPL that floats on top of the water table. And obviously this process only works for LNAPLs. But on the other hand, it's very robust for LNAPL removal, simply because there's no moving parts. There's a high vacuum pump, and that's what you see all the way to the right in this slide, that applies a vacuum, and then the NAPL is transported to the treatment system, and from there is separated and treated. Once we look at what happens in the process system, well, we're dealing a lot with emulsions and bios when we look at NAPL sites. Often we have to add additives to basically prevent or basically separate the emulsions and basically separate the NAPLs out. And this is basically an example from a site where we started out with this. We called it apple source, because that's exactly what it looked like. And by adding additives, we were able to separate out the LNAPL and then treat the water afterwards and get rid of the cloudy matter in the middle. In other process system considerations are shown on this slide. This would be enough material for a separate presentation, but the separation step is something that can be very difficult. Storage, on-site storage and disposal, and then obviously maintenance of the entire system. So I'll wrap up the presentation with presenting three quick case studies. The first one here is from a waste oil site that I believe Eva actually will dive a little deeper into after me here. But as you can see at this particular site, we removed a total of 150,000 pounds of mass, and 87% or 130,000 pounds of that was actually LNAPL. So had we not designed for it, we would have left a lot of NAPL behind. In this case to the right, you can see that the peak NAPL removal was in the order of 7,000 pounds. So that's basically what we got to be prepared to treat when we are looking at some of the high mass sites. This second one was a TGH site. DNAPL was pooled on a tight clay layer towards the bottom of the site. We ended up removing a total of 50,000 pounds of mass, and more than 90% of that mass came out as an apple. So same story, you know, very important that we had a good and robust apple capturing system. Otherwise, we would not have removed this kind of mass. And the last one is a jet fuel site. This was a site we attacked using the steam enhanced extraction as technology. We removed a total of 2.6 million pounds of mass over roughly a year and a half, and roughly half of it, 1.4 million pounds, came out as an apple, and the other roughly three million pounds were treated in an associated vapor system. And in this case, actually, we were treating up towards 12,000 pounds, or removing up towards 12,000 pounds of mass on a daily basis. So in conclusion, well, especially, you know, that some of the chemical mixes actually does require the thermal vendor to focus a lot on the NAPL recovery. And It's very important, obviously, to identify that upfront and create a extraction system that can handle it. The viscosity change is very hard to accurately predict sometimes. You may know it from be able to look it up or research it for individual chemicals, but when you have it in a big mix of several hundred chemicals, it can be very difficult to predict. So we typically end up doing a turbidity study to basically understand it. Just a little side note, when doing a NAPL recovery site like this, not all the NAPL may come out, but what is left, what survives, getting up to at least the temperature of the boiling point of water and maintaining it for several weeks, if a chemical survives that, it's typically not very mobile in the subsurface afterwards, and therefore the environmental risk is substantial less when the site cools down. But I think one of the takeaway points from today is that, the thermal design definitely has to carefully take into account and consider how the NAPL mass is mobilized and captured and treated in the well field. That's all I add.
Great. Thank you so much, Stefan. Now we're going to move on to our third and last speaker. Dr. Eva Davis with EPA's Office of Research and Development has been a hydrogeologist at EPA since 1990. She is EPA's expert on thermal remediation and provides technical support to EPA regions on thermal projects. I know Eva has helped me numerous times on several projects I've worked on that have thermal remediation approaches. Broadcasting from Ada, Oklahoma, here's Eva.
Thank you, Diana. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Great. I've been having difficulties here at home with ice storm and loss of electricity. My lights just flickered again. If I lose my electricity, I lose phone as well. So let's hope that we make it through this. Okay. Hopefully you can see on your screen my presentation on the challenges of thermal remediation at two waste oil Superfund sites. Stefan's presentation was a great introduction for what I'm talking about. He talked about recovering NAPLs. I'm going to be talking mostly about the challenges that we faced at these two sites with then treating those NAPLs and contaminants once they were at the subsurface, because that was the challenges that we really faced at these sites for the most part. I have to hand it to the thermal vendors for having really perfected their ability to recover the contaminants, and now the next challenge is treating them once they reach the subsurface, or once they reach the surface. The two pictures here, I want to recognize my two co-authors as well. The RPMs from these two sites on the left-hand side is the SRSNE site, and Karen Lamino, who retired just at the end of last week, was the RPM for more than 20 years on that site, worked with very well. On the right-hand side is a picture of phase one from the Beatty waste oil site. Cheryl Sprague was the RPM I worked with on that site. Once again, the RPMs really make this a help to make the remediation successful. Next slide, please. And I cannot see the screen that you have, so hopefully we're going to be able to stay coordinated here on the slides. I want to first give an overview of both of the sites so that you know what we're talking about here. SRSNE was really Solvent Recovery Services of New England. It was located in Salington, Connecticut. It operated from 1955 to 1991, distilling solvents. And as commonly happens at these types of facilities, there were discharges to the subsurface, some accidental, some actually planned. The NAPL that was in the subsurface there was approximately 55% TCE by weight, and there were other chlorinated solvents there, as well as plenty of petroleum hydrocarbons and PCBs as well. That was estimated that as much as 200 or excuse me, 2 million pounds of NAPL might have been located within the thermal treatment area. The ROD was signed in 2005 and selected Institute Thermal Remediation to recover the NAPL from the overburden. And that's really a key part of this, is that we were going after the NAPL that was in the overburden, and the remedial objective was just to eliminate the free phase product. So with that in mind, that's why you see the soil cleanup levels here, that they were all of them within the tens to hundreds of milligrams per kilogram range. Next slide, please. Just real quickly, thermal conductive heating. There are two different types of conductive heating that are available now for remediation, electrical or gas combustion fueled. We use the electrical technology at this site, where the well was at very high temperatures and the heated the soil adjacent to it, and then the thermal conductivity of the soil moved the heat into the adjacent soils. So at the actual treatment temperature at distance away from the heater wells was the boiling point of water. Heater wells were installed vertically in a triangular pattern, approximately 12 feet spacing, and they had co-located vapor extraction wells, and that's an important point for this site, that all of the contaminants were recovered in the vapor phase. Next slide, please. Okay, at the SRSNE site, it was approximately a 1.7-acre site. More than 700 heater wells with co-located vapor recovery extraction wells were installed here. We estimated that almost 500,000 pounds of the VOCs were recovered during this remediation. It dropped the average soil total VOCs from 2,800 milligrams per kilogram down to about 5.5 milligrams per kilogram, the three orders of magnitude drop. And if you remember what the soil cleanup goals were from a couple of slides ago, this is well below then the cleanup criteria that we had. And this also brought about a 95% reduction in the VOC concentrations in groundwater. Next slide. Now to move on to the Beattie Waste Oil site, the second of the two sites. This site's located in Placetown, New Hampshire, and it operated from 1926 up to 1994 with mostly blending oils. And since this was more of an oil operation, more of what was ended up in the subsurface here was petroleum hydrocarbons, but of course there was the chlorinated solvents mixed in with that then. And the LNAPL at this site covered approximately 3 acres. From 2001 to 2005, an LNAPL recovery system was operated here just using vacuum extraction, essentially a slurping type operation, as Stefan was talking about not long ago, and it recovered approximately 90,000 gallons of LNAPL. But as you'll see, a whole lot more remained in the subsurface. The ROD for this site was signed in 2004, and it called for SVE, soil vapor extraction, to treat the source area with a thermal enhancement if it was necessary. During the pre-design investigation, the site owners became well convinced that indeed a thermal enhancement was going to be needed to meet the soil criteria for this site, and ultimately steam enhanced extraction was chosen as the remedy. Next slide, please. And hopefully you've already seen a description of how the steam enhanced extraction works. You know, basically you've got the steam injections surrounding your napple areas, and the steam then displaces the napples to a central extraction well. And that is a multi-phase extraction well, as Stefan mentioned. And that's an important point for this site, is that the contaminants were extracted both as a non-aqueous phase liquid with dissolved in groundwater and as vapors. This was a large enough site, and the steam injection well spacing was close enough that we used the seven-spot pattern for where six in steam injection wells surrounded each of the extraction wells that were in the center. Next slide, please. So at the BD site, we did this in two different phases. The first phase was done in 2015 and 16, approximately 13,300 cubic yards were treated, and over 1,700 gallons of NAPL was recovered. Most of the, as Stefan has already mentioned, most of what was recovered here was in the was as a NAPL. Once phase one was completed, then we took the lessons learned from that and moved on to phase two, treated more than 21,000 cubic yards, and recovered from this site 37,000 gallons of NAPL, although there's a little play in that number. Once we started taking the above ground system apart, we found a whole lot more NAPL. So there was more there than what we were counting. Anyway, but ultimately the strict soil cleanup criteria that we had for this site that were meant to be protective of groundwater, those criteria were met at the end of the steam injection for both of the phase one and phase two areas. Next slide, please. So what challenges did we have to overcome here? The first challenge at that they had at the SRSNE site was determining the top of the bedrock. The objective here was to treat the entire overburden with the knowledge that there was DNAPL pooled on top of that bedrock in some areas. The site characterization to determine our treatment area was done using a direct push technology, which worked well for the characterization, except for the fact that it generally met refusal at the top of the weathered bedrock and not at the top. And did not make it to the top of the competent bedrock. But knowing that there was DNAPL pooled on top of the competent bedrock, we had a desire to treat to that depth. So when we installed this system, we used sonic drilling, and I'll talk more about that in a minute here, to install the heater wells. And that allowed us then to get to the competent bedrock and to actually go within it. However, that had the effect of then increasing our treatment volume by approximately 20%. And this comes after we'd already done the design, necessitating some redesign to ensure that we had enough energy then to treat our entire volume. Next slide, please. And as I mentioned, there were DNAPL pools on top of that fractured bedrock. We were aware of that fact, and we had no desire to allow vertical migration of that DNAPL into the bedrock. So they developed a drilling protocol using the sonic drilling for the installation of the heater wells to be used at this site. Casing was installed ahead of the drilling. And that casing was left in place until the heater cans were installed. And once the boring had reached the desired depth, which was about 2 feet into the competent bedrock, then the bottom of the borehole was probed to see if there DNAPL was present. And if DNAPL was present, it was recovered. And if we go on to the next slide here, you can see them doing that with the peristaltic pump, and some of the DNAPL that was recovered from some of these borings, DNAPL that was recovered rather than allowing it to migrate further into bedrock. Go on to the next slide. And because of the different methods of recovering the contaminants at these two sites, at SRS and Eager, it was all recovered in the vapor phase. At BD site, the vast majority was recovered as an LNAPL. It required different strategies for the effluent treatment. At SRSNE, the above ground vapor treatment system really was trying to emphasize maintaining those contaminants in the vapor phase, and then they were destroyed in the thermal oxidizer that's pictured here. What LNAPL or DNAPL was collected was just in 55-gallon drums. I believe there was five or so total. So the majority of the contaminants were destroyed here on site. And as we've already talked about some, too, with the BD site, the majority of the contaminants being recovered as an LNAPL that were then shipped off-site. We did also have a Thermox at that site for the vapors, for the non-condensables, but the vast majority of it, as I said, was recovered as an LNAPL and then sent off-site to be destroyed. Next slide. Just the sheer size of these two sites presented real challenges, and the size of the site as well as the amount of mass present. This is the SRSNE site again. As I said, at BD, we had two distinct areas that were treated as phase one and phase two. At the SRSNE site, we had one large area that was all highly contaminated, and to try to treat the whole site at one time would have been necessitated an extremely large above ground treatment system. So the strategy that we used here was to divide the site into two different phases, start the phase one, the upgradient portion initially, and then once we had gotten past the maximum mass recovery from the phase one area, then we would bring the phase two area up to temperature and maximize that mass recovery. And you can see the mass recovery rate in the blue line on the graph on this slide. We were fairly successful then in spreading this out. However, we did the sheer amount of mass that had to be recovered did cause some other problems, which I'll be talking about here. Moving on to slide 13, the challenge of separating that oil that was recovered from the groundwater. Although at SRSNE they were trying to keep as much of the contaminants as possible in the vapor phase, they still there was enough condensed groundwater in NAPL that it was passed through an oil-water separator, and of course that was an even bigger component of the system at BD where we knew we were recovering them in the liquid phases. And in both cases we ended up with some problems fairly early on with NAPL passing through these separators, but it caused different problems at the sites. Next slide, please. At BD, that NAPL that made it through the oil-water separator ended up in the reinjection basin. And this was partially caused by one of the things that Stefan was talking about, the biological growth creating an LNAPL and water emulsion. So the solution to this was the addition of biocides early on in the treatment system. And also we went through a lot of jar tests to determine the pH and ferric chloride addition that was needed to get the best separation between the NAPL and the groundwater. Additional organic clay filters were added to the system. And what you see here in the reinjection basin, these oily soils were excavated from there and to be disposed of properly, and what dissolved contaminants there were discharged were then recovered by the pump and treat system that was operational throughout this time. So ultimately, no damage done by this, and we did not then again encounter a similar problem. We were able to go through the rest of phase one and phase and throughout phase two without having this problem again. Next slide, please. At the SRSNE site, like I said, a little bit different problem occurred. The NAPL that made it through the oil-water separator ended up then being revaporized and and caused combustion in the pre-oxidizer heat exchanger, and damaging the daisy wheel at that oxidizer inlet. And that's what's pictured here, is that damaged daisy wheel. So the solution in this case was, again, organoclay filters that were added after the oil water separator to make sure that if something did come through that separator, it did not make it any further. And also they added temperature sensors at the oxidizer inlet and reduced that that temperature set point so that if NAPL were to make it through there, or this high energy NAPL were to make it that far, it would not combust in that heat exchanger. Luckily, we had built into the system a backup of vapor phase activated carbon, which we were used for that time while we were getting the Thermox fixed. It's always good to have a backup on site. Next slide, please. Challenge we had at the BD site was in terms of some of the naturally occurring arsenic and bromide. The bromide itself is not a huge problem, except in this case, what went through the advanced oxidation treatment system at the site then created bromate, which there is a discharge limit for. And so we had to stop recycling, stop treating through that advanced oxidation system the water that was recycled back into the sea system. As far as the arsenic goes, you can see in the graph here that upper blue line shows that there were very significant arsenic removal during the thermal remediation, and very strict discharge, although it was naturally occurring in the first place and had come out of the ground, we could not just re-inject it. We had to treat down to 10 micrograms per liter before it could be re-injected. Microfiltration, arsenic adsorption media were used. They did a lot of adjusting of the pH and ferric chloride additions to precipitate out that arsenic. There were problems that were ultimately treated in all cases then. Next slide, please. Stefan has already talked about this a little bit. We at the BD site in the phase one area, after we had already met all this soil cleanup criteria, we still found that there was some NAPL remaining at the site. Up until about the end of last year, they'd recovered about 80 gallons of NAPL from that phase one treatment area. And so what we did with phase two was to include a slurper system, as Stefan has basically talked about, where we were able to recover then from the extraction wells using a vacuum any LNAPL that was accumulating on top of the water table that was not being extracted by the pumps. We do know that we recovered significant LNAPL using this method throughout the phase two treatment. It's not clear yet whether this is going to you know, how much LNAPL is going to remains in that phase two area that will now accumulate in wells. But we do know that, that this method was very helpful. I don't know how I'm doing time-wise, but under the next slide, the challenge of winter operation in New England. Both of these sites were in New England, but they actually caused a little bit different problems for us. At the SRSNE site, we were looking for the completion of our of the remediation, but we found that in the winter, the loss of heat from the surface was allowing vapor to condense underneath the cap. We added insulation to the cap. We increased the energy that was going into the upper part of that of the subsurface formation, and we did then meet our soil cleanup criteria even in the shallow zones during the winter. For the BD site, we had tried to not be operating during winter. Didn't want the competition with the surrounding residential areas for the use of the natural gas. But we did end up operating some during colder months and had some problems with water lines freezing and damage. Heat tracing there is your solution. Next slide, please. The last challenge I want to talk about here was a situation at the BD site where they had NAPL that extended all the way to the surface water. It's hard to see on this figure here, but just to the north of the dashed purple line was Kelly Brook that went through this area. The NAPL extended right up to the brook. Interceptor trench had been installed to intercept that the NAPL migrating in that direction. So when it comes to treating this area, a sheet pile wall was installed. You can see that as a green line in the figure. It was right at the top of a hill, and then from there it went down. It sloped downward to the north to the interceptor trench and then the creek. And this sheet pile wall then separated the area, the phase two treatment area, from the area to the north of that sheet pile wall that is then to be excavated to recover it. And the sheet pile wall did a very good job of stopping, didn't eliminate steam moving to the north of it into the untreated area, but it held enough of it back to minimize it, help to minimize the impacts to the north. What did, although they're not shown here, extraction wells were installed to the north of that sheet pile wall that recovered some of the NAPL from that area and allowed us to remediate to the south of the wall with this with steam injection and meet our remedial goals. Had we known then what we know now, we would have extended that sheet pile wall, particularly on the eastern end of it, and I think we would have sealed the joint so that we didn't have as much of the energy going to the north side. Next slide, please. Takeaway messages from this. The thermal remediation was successful in meeting the soil cleanup criteria for both of these sites. And in fact, at the SRSNE site, where we were just trying to eliminate the NAPL, we actually exceeded our soil cleanup criteria by 1 to 2 orders of magnitude. The challenges that we were dealing with here had more to do with the large amounts of mass that were recovered, and then sometimes the then at BD, especially the natural conditions, the weather and the geochemistry of the groundwater. But we were ultimately able to meet these challenges, and so that then our discharge to the groundwater and air were met. And next slide, please. With that, thank you for your attention. And I would like to recognize, without trying to name everybody, the very large groups of people that worked on these sites. It requires a lot of teamwork to make remediations like this successful, and I would like to recognize those people. Anyway, with
thank
that,
so
I'll turn it back to Diana.
Okay, perfect. Thanks so much, Eva. Thank you to all of our three speakers, Lauren, Stefan, and Eva, and to you, our audience, for your great questions. Sadly, we are running behind. We will need to jump to the next session right now. We do promise to get back to you. For those of you who typed in the questions, we'll get back to you via email or some other method with Jean's help. I do want to say the poll results showed that the majority of the audience really had little experience with thermal, and with the people that did have experience with thermal showed that ERH, electric resistance heating, really was the most commonly used thermal remediation method. But we hope this panel improved your knowledge and encouraged consideration of thermal in your future project. And with that, I am going to turn it back to Kate. Thank you.
Thank you, Diana, so much, and I echo your thanks to the panel. I do want to point out, and Jean mentioned this in the beginning, we do have PDF versions of the slides. I think there was such a wealth of knowledge that was shared in that last panel, and I apologize that we couldn't get to questions, but if you'd like to review some of the information, there's a lot of things to consider and lessons learned. I highly encourage you to revisit the slides or reach out to any of our presenters. So, Jean, let's do a quick sound check, and then we'll move on to panel four.
All right, great. Thank you so very much, Kate. I'd like to check first to see if Eric White is on the phones.
I'm here.
Thank you very much. I'd like to check to see if Tim Cushman is on the line.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. And Janine Latham, are you with us?
I am.
And last, Chuck, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. It looks like we have all speakers accounted for. So, Kate, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you so much, Jean. So we're going to change gears for the last panel today, panel four. We're going to be having three great and diverse presentations talking about the use of modern technology to improve design and construction activities at hazardous waste sites. So I'm going to introduce our moderator, Eric White from PARS Environmental. Eric is a registered professional geologist and certified hydrogeologist with over 19 years of technical and regulatory experience. He holds an MS in hydrogeology from the University of New Hampshire and a BS in environmental science and geology from the State University of New York, Plattsburgh. His HTRW experience includes design and oversight of field investigations, CERCLA implementation, innovative field investigation methods, remedial design and implementation of both in-situ and ex-situ solutions, solid and hazardous waste management, regulatory compliance overviews, permitting, and risk management. So, Eric, it sounds like you do it all. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you to get this panel started.
Very good. All right. Thank you, Kate. And thanks, everyone, in the panel and to everyone who's listening. So panel four, this is about using modern technology to improve remedial design and remedial action. As a lot of you probably know, the widespread application of modern technology to most phases of almost all types of environmental remediation is expanding very quickly. This rapid innovation in remediation tech is further driving, further development of more tech for use both in the field and at our desktops. And these enhanced means available to identify and characterize and mitigate environmental problems has drastically improved our ability to design and execute more efficiently, more successfully, and much more safely. The tools of modern tech allow us to optimize our efforts towards better solutions, decrease risk in the face of truncated schedules and shrinking budgets. So to that end, during this panel, we're going to hear three examples of how smart use of innovative modern technology can be leveraged to meet these challenges. We'll see this modern tech deployed in the air, on land, and at sea. We're going to experience the application of modern tech to fire, radiological contamination, and massive fuel releases. We'll learn how to leverage modern tech to better communicate with stakeholders, optimize real-time decision-making, and see into the future. We'll see it in 2D, 3D, and in video. So again, we have a great panel. I'm looking forward to this. As we move through, please do submit questions to the speakers, and if you could indicate, you know, who the question is addressed to. And with that, I'll get started. So our first speaker is Mr. Timothy Cushman. He's a GIS professional with over 12 years experience as a GIS leader in environmental engineering and consulting industry. His technical expertise includes 3D modeling and data visualization, GIS and GPS asset management, and relational database management. At Ramboll, he supports numerous environmental and hazardous waste projects from the initial site characterization through remedial investigation and design, feasibility studies, and regulatory reporting. Tim has a bachelor's degree in conservation and environmental science from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's one of our 94 SAMI Young members here today, and he is a U.S. Army veteran who deployed twice in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. So, Tim, thanks very much, and take it away.
Thank you very much, Eric. Hello, everybody. My name is Tim Cushman. I'm a certified GIS professional with Ramboll, located in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Today, I'd like to talk to you about drones, LiDAR, and 3D models. The title of my presentation is A New Paradigm for Data Visualization and Analysis and the Project Management Benefits for Large Hazardous Waste Remediation Projects. The case study for my talk today is the former Chambers Works Bootstrap site located in Deepwater, New Jersey, which is managed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Philadelphia District. Let's get started with a brief site overview. The site location is in Salem County, New Jersey, and the overall property is about 680 acres, but the area of active remediation is approximately 6.5 acres. This is a figure from the remedial investigation report completed about a decade ago, and you can see the areas of interest are these crosshatched areas in the figure. Moving on to a bit of site history. In the 1940s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Manhattan Engineering District and the Atomic Energy Commission contracted DuPont to support the nation's atomic energy program at this site. Then in 1997, the Army Corps was directed by Congress to conduct assessment, remedial action, and site closure activities for bootstrap sites, including this one. Currently, today, the Army Corps is addressing residual radiological contamination and multiple AOCs on the site under the bootstrap program. The initial on-site contractor for this project utilized conventional radiological data collection techniques and rudimentary 2D data representation to guide soil excavation efforts and final status reports. Even though it was the industry standard at the time, this approach did not meet the Philadelphia District's expectations. The district envisioned a better way to collect and process and utilize remedial action RAD data that would enable the project team to optimize operations, perform predictive planning, and document expectations. USAFE needed a contractor to model and visualize these data, these new data, so they procured these and other services from Ramboll. USAFE then led a collaborative team effort with Sevenson Environmental Services and Ramboll to develop and implement an optimized data flow process. The remainder of my presentation focuses on Ramboll's contribution to USAFE's comprehensive 3D data management and visualization system. So Ramboll brings a number of solutions to this table. The first one being GIS. It may not need to be stated on this call. I'm sure that many of you are familiar with GIS or use it yourself. But just to illustrate what GIS is briefly, GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems. It is a tool to collect geographic data from many disparate data sources and put it in the same spatial context so that we can use it to gain deeper insights on our project. If we take that stack that we just saw building in the previous slide and then push it into the cloud, this is a good representation of what we're doing on the project. So we take all of our geographic information and put it into the cloud, and we have a number of different tools and functions that we can perform. First one being the system of record. It was critically important to the Army Corps of Engineers that we document and maintain records of all the information, and we're doing that with our system of record. Secondly is a system of engagement. This is a generic term for sharing information. Traditionally, GIS has been a desktop application and only experienced users can have access to it. But more and more every day, we find that we have robust tools to share data and communicate maps and dashboards and findings with all stakeholders involved. Finally is our system of insight. This is a term which implies analysis, spatial analysis, geostatistical analysis, 3D and temporal analysis that we can perform on higher end desktop hardware and software and then bring into this collaborative platform. So then we take these core components and we move them into what would be considered a geospatial infrastructure. And credit goes to Esri for this slide. It's a perfect illustration of how we are implementing our technology on this project. So our data and our structure exist within the cloud, and they enable this these building blocks to help us do our work. So yes, we can do mapping and specific GIS projects. We do lots of types of data visualization. We visualize real-time data. We visualize temporal and 3D data. A little bit later, I'll be showing you some field operations of how we're actually using this technology to enhance the data collection process to get off of paper forms and collect everything electronically to speed up the workflow. And I mentioned analysis briefly, and dashboards have been a very successful tool for us as well. It's a great way to distill geographic information and put it into context so that key decision makers and collaborators can at a glance see what's going on with the project, monitor timelines and budgets, and get key geographic information in context in real time. A few key highlights of ArcGIS Online before I move on to the next solution is that it features real-time data access. We can query and visualize data in real time. Again, I mentioned this earlier, it incorporates all available data sources. So I'll talk in a little while about orthoimagery, LiDAR data, GPS information, et cetera. We can incorporate all of that. Very importantly, this provides a common operating picture for all team members so that the right people are getting the right information at the right time. It helps speed up the decision-making process. It helps enable clear and concise communication. It allows mobile access through electronic field data collection. And then really the bottom line is that this is a very dynamic system that is custom tailored on nearly a daily basis to meet ever-changing project needs. This is a screenshot of one web application, and I'll move into a video here in just a second to illustrate just one concept of how web applications work. So this is a web application that we built early on to help track the drone imagery that we are capturing on a weekly basis to monitor construction activities. So at a glance, we can flip through week by week and look at the high-resolution ortho imagery and even get tools such as this slider tool to compare and contrast week over week or month over month or start to finish. We can also use this same tool with any layer in the map so that we could look at the digital elevation model, for example, and see how that compares to the imagery that's underlying it. A fairly simple tool that's readily built within GIS but delivers a lot of power and speed for data presentation. So our next solution is the electronic field data collection. This is not anything new, but this has been around for quite a while, but is a critical component of this project. So the illustration on the right, as you see, the graphic you see is the Finster radiation scanning system. The health physicists at Sevenson, the Army Corps of Engineers helped collaborate to put together this system, which is essentially a stroller or with a bunch of equipment mounted into it, into a specialized data capture device, so that our field technicians can wirelessly walk the site and collect real-time RTK GPS data with high precision, high accuracy, centimeter grade accuracy, and capture this data and process it near real time so that we can get that data out of the field and into our system quickly. Here's a brief video Gene, if you could pull up this video, please. Thank you. Here's a brief video illustrating that concept. So there's the Finster in action. Here's a field technician operating some of the equipment. She's holding an iPad in her hand. And as you can see, interacting real time with ArcGIS Collector. So in Collector, you go to your map, you select your point, and from that point, you launch a survey using Survey123. We can see that we have lots of options to customize these surveys. We can add drop boxes and pick lists and radio buttons. This is on an iPad, so we can use the camera for scanning things like unique barcodes. So we're barcoding every individual sample. We have time and date selectors so that we're accurately capturing information. And we can even do things like concatenate these fields into a single unique field ID so that no sample is ever lost or mislabeled. If you need to, you can capture photos, take notes, add other kinds of information, or you just hit the submit button. We hit send. This is enabled, wirelessly enabled, and so this data now went from the field directly into the cloud, and we're seeing it in real time. Gene, if you could go back to the slides, please. That workflow alone has saved tremendous amounts of time in the data collection and transcription process and nearly eliminated all paper workflows. As I mentioned, there are numerous field applications for electronic field data collection. These are some out-of-the-box solutions from Esri. The ones that we are using are Collector for ArcGIS, Survey123 for ArcGIS, and Operations Dashboard. And for those of you who are interested, I've put some hyperlinks at the bottom of this slide, which will take you to the product page so you can learn more about these. See if I skipped the slide here, and I didn't. Okay, solution number three. One of my favorites is drones. Drones for a specialized application for collecting LiDAR data and high-resolution imagery. This is an illustration of one of our drone platforms. Our technology platform is an 8-rotor octocopter with a gimbal and a sensor array mount. On this sensor array, we have two sensors currently. One is a LiDAR sensor. Traditionally, LiDAR has really only been flown from fixed-wing aircraft. But drone technology has advanced so greatly that we're able to mount a LiDAR sensor. And for those of you who aren't familiar with LiDAR, LiDAR stands for light detection and ranging. It's like radar, but with lasers. And when we fly this over a site, we collect 1.2 million points per second. The extent of the range of this sensor is about 100 meters. And our final end products are within plus or minus 10 centimeter accuracy. So we can very quickly and very accurately survey large sites and inaccessible sites with full coverage. The other sensor we have on this platform is a high-resolution digital camera to collect RGB images for stitching together into an ortho mosaic, a mosaic of ortho images, so that we can have our high-resolution imagery. And then the last key component shown in the background is our PPK GPS. This ties all the positional information together so that when we map this data, it lands in the right place. Right, so a few more pieces about drones. If you're not familiar with them, I highly suggest that you learn. It's a very beneficial technology, and some of the benefits we've seen is that it's a very highly adaptable platform. We can collect data from low altitude. We can collect data at will. If something happened today, we need to get it, we can go get it today. And the quick turnaround time is very quick. Traditional imagery, you could wait 9 months, 12 months for a contractor to deliver it, and here we're getting 24 hours. One of the other benefits is the resolution. The best off-the-shelf imagery maybe is 1 foot, 1 meter sometimes for federal programs. We're routinely getting less than 0.5 inches per pixel, which in my opinion is the best available imagery today. And there's no comparison, really, to modern satellite imagery. The map I'm showing on the right-hand side is one from Bing Maps. Bing is generally considered to have pretty timely, up-to-date information and high-resolution imagery. But when you compare it to ours, there really is no comparison. Here we can see the truck on the left-hand center side is our field technician's truck, where we launched the drone from. and we just captured this last week. So again, very timely. The other piece of information, oh, and we can also see individual people in this imagery. So again, very high resolution, better than anything you could get today. What we get from our LiDAR sensor is a point cloud. These are often on the order of 40, 50 million points per point cloud. And we need to do some processing with that. It's incredibly dense. It's also incredibly accurate and precise. So we process our point cloud. We can classify things like the power lines or ground surface or vegetation. And we can get that information out of there so that we can derive digital elevation models. That allows us to do things like volumetric analysis and geospatial interpretation. And the last piece I mentioned before was that it allows us to get really full coverage. This in the center, this light blue, this is water. And traditional survey may get a few points along the edge of it. We captured 100% of it in very high resolution. Solution number four, centralized database management. This is core to all the GIS work that I do at Ramble and is a very key component of this. I'm not going to read through all the bullets, but really I think of this as a table with four legs, and you have to have all four of these for success. The first leg is reporting. The second is record keeping. The third is data centralization. And then the fourth is scalability. We are accomplishing these four tasks through these three solutions or three groupings of solutions. So through our ArcGIS Online portal, we are doing our mapping and real-time visualization and electronic field data collection. We leverage Microsoft SharePoint in a multi-user environment, a secure cloud environment for an online perpetual data repository. And we also leverage Equus and SQL and whatever other data management software we may need to have a scalable system for capturing and maintaining and reporting data. Solution number five is 3D visualization and modeling. Without the previous four steps, there's no way we could do this. And this is what really gets me excited, is the 3D visualization part. So in order to demonstrate this, I have a short video. This is an illustration of a 3D model, an animation really, which shows a high resolution drone image captured of our site in February. And this is draped on top of the high resolution digital elevation model. From this right away, we could capture volumetric data in real time. So if you want to track that for your project, that's done. We can then do things like drape GPS information on top. This is a gamma scan from the system I showed you earlier. We are dropping the high-resolution GPS data onto our digital elevation model, and then we can start to model in 3D. We can turn on elevation contours if we'd like. Now we have a grayscale background or for the topo, and we can eliminate that and then look at the 3D model itself in the subsurface and do some unique visualization. So here I'm subsetting by 1/2 foot depth intervals. So we can use this to predictively, to predict where contamination may continue to exceed threshold or where contamination may stop. And we had some great success with this and continue to use it on a daily basis for excavation tracking and monitoring and data visualization. All right, so the key takeaway from my talk today is this. Any one of these individual pieces of technology that I presented today could yield a measurable benefit for your project. And these can be used a la carte to some extent. However, we've learned that if you approach a project with a comprehensive, innovative digital strategy, even for a project as large and complex as ChambersWorks, you will realize deep and meaningful benefits, all the way from improving your timeline to saving your bottom line. Finally, true success is only being achieved through daily interactive collaboration with the Army Corps, Sevenson, Galago, and Ramble. And with that, I'd like to thank some of my colleagues for making this all happen, and thank all of you for listening to my talk today. Back to you, Eric.
Okay, Tim, thanks very much. That was, well done. That was really a great presentation. Just another reminder to everyone to, you know, submit some questions for the panelists as we go along, and if you want to indicate who you want that question to go to, you know, as we go through the other two presentations, or if it's more in general in nature, just indicate that, please, in the Q&A box. So let's see. So our next speaker is Janine Latham. She is the National Geospatial Technical Director for Weston Solutions. She has over 18 years experience as an IT and GIS professional, including 15 years providing such services on EPA projects. Her expertise lies in emergency response, data collection workflows, and Esri Enterprise architecture and real-time data capture and visualization. She holds a Bachelor's of Science degree in both Earth Science and Environmental Resource Management from Penn State University. So Janine, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Can everybody hear me? Did I unmute myself correctly, Jean?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you. So thanks for the time today. Today we're gonna talk about the utilization of the ArcGIS platforms. So the topic right before ours really is helping leading into this conversation. So I thank you for that. So we're going to focus on how we use the platform for wildfire response within the 2018 California wildfires. But, when we submitted this abstract and started putting this presentation together, that was before the current 2020 wildfires. So a lot of this discussion today are topics and lessons learned that we not only applied through the 2018 fires in EPA Region 9, but also I can, happily say that those same lessons learned and the enterprise architecture that we're about to talk about, we're applying both in the wildfires for Region 9 and 10, so both in Oregon and in California. So just wanted to give you a little bit more, background on Weston and our emergency response. Up on the slide there are just a number of responses that we've evolved our GIS and data management application in over the last, 15 to 18 years. Weston, we support, the EPA START contracts. We've been in a number of regions over the years. We also support the Corps' RDI contracts where we've applied a lot of these GIS and data management techniques there as well. So let's get into, there we go. Just want to briefly touch on the enterprise and what we're going to reference the enterprise. Like I said in the presentation before, I kind of gave a good introductory to that as well. So when we talk about the enterprise in today's discussion, we're really talking about the hardware and software and the services that we use to do GIS and data management application throughout response. We utilize it on the data collection piece. We use Collector, Survey123, sometimes FileMaker, and other Esri-based products, Workforce and Quick Capture and things like that. On our mobile collection devices, and we're feeding that into our cloud architecture. The EPA response team has a set of Amazon servers that each region is able to utilize for emergency response. So we really take advantage of that to provide the benefit of real-time data collection for response. I started doing response data back in, 2005 for Hurricane Katrina, and I always tell the story how if I could tell the EPA, where they were 2 days ago and what they did 2 days ago, they were really happy with that, right? Now we're expecting with the enterprise, we want to turn that data around as quickly as possible, and we're talking about half hour, hour increments to say what the teams are currently doing. So to kind of grow up in that GIS enterprise and really push the limits of that and to see it really benefit our response teams and our response partners through the enterprise has really been a neat experience for me. So with the EPA allowing for the use of these cloud servers and then also their ArcGIS Online, which we tag as the EPA Geo Platform, putting these two things together to form our enterprise to be able to collect data and then report out in any number of standard applications has been a growth and has been providing a lot of success. And when we say success, we mean, you know, we are shortening our time frames of what, you know, the schedules of things of how this would happen. For the 2018 fires, you know, we had a projected schedule of 6 months. We completed that, the EPA and START and Weston, you know, helped to complete that within a three-month time frame. And we like to say that the data management activities helped to support that increased schedule there. So we'll touch on what the 2018 fires, just to refresh everybody there on. So, oops, that skipped too quickly. So there was the Camp Fire, which was up in Northern California, which affected Butte County. And then also there was the Woolsey and Hill fires that were down in LA and Ventura County. So the EPA created one incident command, as you can see here in the map, you know, very far apart. So we created one, EPA created one incident command to manage both operations. We considered them the North and the South operations, but the main driver was to have one command so that we could be working with the response partners as well as the state and local governments in the same way and have the same data quality objectives for both responses, and so that could also be reported out to the public in the same way for both for all three of the fire perimeters that we were collecting household hazardous waste for. So prior to the 2018 fires, there were the 2017 fires in Northern California. And EPA and Weston, as their START contractors, were part of the 2017 fires. And we had a lot of lessons learned coming out of that. So when 2018 came around and those fires hit in Northern California and Southern California, we decided to really take a look and look at what had happened during 2017, and from a data management and a data quality objective standpoint, try to apply some of the lessons learned coming out of that. The three big things really were the coordination, the organization, and the planning. Coordination being number one. From the start, about 2 weeks before we embarked on our field operations, coordination among EPA, FEMA, all the state agencies, including DTSE and CAL FIRE, down to the local, the state and local agencies and the counties, the coordination surrounding GIS and data management started before we even hit the field. We all agreed on one central platform to share our information, which was ArcGIS Online and the EPA's GEO platform. We also agreed on one authoritative reporting data source, which was the EPA's database there too. And so that coordination between the responding agencies really led to the great successes that they had out there to really get folks back into their communities to be able to rebuild. The organization aspect there, and we'll get into that here in the next slide, but we integrated GIS and data management into ICS from day one as well as into operations. We used a hybrid model of being able to collect data using Collector and Survey 123, and we also, for this response, decided to go with a data-driven operational status, and we'll get into more details there as well later on in the presentation. The other big lesson learned was the public communication and how that was going to be shared in a consistent manner. And we did that through EPA GEO platform, through the use of story maps as well there. And we'll take a look at that a little later. So we talked about putting, you know, good coordination and planning. And a lot of that has to do with putting where does data fall into the ICS organization. That's always the question. You know, it's not a specific unit. It's not, you know, it typically sits under situation there. And so for for the 2018 fires, what Region 9 really focused on was putting data at the top, at the command level. So you can see here in the, I don't know if my mouse is working on here, but up under incident command, the deputy incident command commander was a data-driven OSC. So the person that was sitting in this box at all times was always concerned with the data quality objectives, making sure that these decisions of what we were collecting, how we were collecting, were being driven down into planning, into ops, into situations, so that message would come from, you know, the top down instead of operations trying to make decisions of what we should collect and if that reflected well within the situation reporting or in the planning and things like that. The other difference for this organizational structure that we did was putting in a data support coordinator that, you know, kind of sat off to the side here, but really helped to drive what the deputy incident commander was talking to, you know, the respective folks about and really driving those data quality objectives. The data quality objectives that were created during the 2018 fires drove the whole response from a data management perspective, and so that we were never collecting information that wasn't important to the decision-making process. And when you don't collect, you know, extraneous information about your operations, it helps you report cleaner and in a high quality fashion, and it helps you translate that into, you know, communication to the public. And so that really, the data quality objectives set out at the beginning of this really helped to drive the high quality of work. The other thing that we put into play was a data collection development and application cycle. During the 2017 fires, I would say we were in an agile development framework where we were updating and changing questions and data values daily. And so if you think about it, when you're distributing a data collection form to, you know, 50 to 60 teams, which is, you know, close to 100 people who are looking at these data collection forms, if you are changing the information that you want them to collect on a daily basis, your data becomes almost irrelevant because you're changing what you're trying to collect on the fly within an operational period. So that was a big lesson learned from 2017 to 2018, where we were going to hold a development cycle so that those questions could be reviewed and decided upon both from the North and the South operations and through incident command. So we would have coordinated meetings, op meetings on Fridays, and that would have operations from the North and the South and then incident command. And everyone would present their findings of, okay, we're seeing this out in the field here. You know, maybe we should collect information there. This agency is asking us for, you know, a specific type of count of materials that we're collecting. The follow-on contractors need to know this information, and we're finding it in different ways. You know, those are just examples. So we would have a review of those questions and the VVLs together as a team, and then those would be pushed to our development team. So Fridays would be our meetings, Saturdays the application would get updated as well as all the relational databases tied to them. We would push and test on Sundays, and then on Monday mornings it would be rolled out to all the field teams with a just-in-time training in the morning. And so what we found there was, you know, the level of quality data that we were getting to be able to report was consistent, and we were able to turn around data, you know, within 12 hours of being collected and QA QC'd to the public and to ops for planning and SIP for situation for reporting. And what allowed us really to do that development cycle, I'm clicking a little too fast here. So what allowed us to do those cycles was the flexible and scalable architecture that we have. we had available to us through AWS. The other thing that happened there and what the enterprise allows us to do is that at the same time, Region 9 was also responding to the U2 response out in U2 in the islands there, the typhoon response, and our servers were getting, the EPA Region 9 servers were getting hammered essentially from all the data collection from both. So we were able to scale out and just have our own fires dedicated server where it was just our data from the response going in there and then all the other responses or the removals that were going on there. So the flexible and scalable architecture and allowing us to also utilize the ArcGIS online, the EPA Geo platform, to be able to host and scale data up there also helped to us being to turn around data quickly and to visualize that on field tablets, you know, in near real time to continue operations. So our data collection method was the hybrid approach here. Gene, can you help me out here? There, thank you. So we use the collector survey 123 hybrid approach that would allow the teams to orient themselves in the field of where they needed to be as well as what property they would need to go to, and then be able to collect that information within the survey 123 form. Back in 2017, we just used collector. And in collector, you don't have all the data controls that you can see here where you can do multiple choice or drop downs and keep those valid values pretty consistent, as well as put data requirements. You can see stars here. That means this information has to be filled out or you can't submit the record. Collector really didn't lend to that during 2017, so we were getting a lot of empty fields, a lot of null data that wasn't really null. It's just that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't restricted to be able to collect that. So what Collector allowed the teams to do is to give them that situational awareness. And like I had mentioned before, you know, the use of the cloud architecture really let us see in real time, you know, where and what was happening out in the field. You know, we had, especially in some of these small, like you can see a lot of parcels in these areas here, the teams, the teams knew where another team was. So it allowed them to be able to not waste time by going and doing a property that somebody maybe had already done, because in their collector they could see, oh, this team completed it, even if it was a half hour ago, they could see that a team had already been there to visit it. Because at the height, especially up in camp, up in Butte County, we had, you know, 30 to 40 teams operating in a very small area. So it was really important that they had that situational awareness. The other thing was is that we also had an arborist team out there to go and tag, you know, if there were tree hazards out there so that a team could plan ahead of time if they knew that there were going to be tree hazards either on the property or on the way to the property that would not, you know, allow easiness to be able to get to that parcel. So the other lesson learned that we took from 2017 was creating survey forms based on an operation and not trying to stuff every question that we wanted to know about the property or the parcel into one form. We had two different forms for campfire, and now in 2020, I think in Oregon or maybe it's California, we have four different forms to control the four different operations that may be happening there. So this model has expanded into the current fires there, which is nice to see. But so for camp in 2018, we had what was called the property note form, which allowed us to collect information about access. You know, all we wanted to know was, is there access there? Are there any physical access issues? We're coming up on a property. We can't do the HHW assessment or the asbestos removal, but we can take notes and information, collect information about why we can't get there. So instead of putting it in the HHW assessment form, or the asbestos collection form, you know, we just put that in the access form so that we could track that separately. Then we, like I said, we would have the HHW form. So the HHW form allowed us to track everything that we were collecting. And it also allowed us to take some notes specifically about if there were any hazards there that the follow-on teams would need to know about. But the HHW collection form allowed us to collect, you know, what we were moving from the property so that we could give that to the county so that when they were contacted by the property owners, they would know what type of HHW was collected or asbestos off their properties. The other thing that Collector allowed the field teams to be able to view were any previous assessments that were there or that were done there, or if that there were any access issues noted before there. So when we would have our revisits or our follow-on visits, they could also see within the Collector application as well as in the survey form, you know, what has already happened there. So we talked about data quality objectives and data standards and the north and the south and being able to use these cloud infrastructures and ArcGIS Online environment. So what we did from a relational database standpoint is that we had a database that was just collecting information. You can see here the HHW and the property information about what was happening in northern operations and then in the southern operations as well. And so these two bottom databases were just for data collection. That was it. They weren't reporting data. They weren't, you know, we weren't editing data there, but what we were doing is we were running QCs, and the QCs were happening and reporting through the fires reporting database, which became the authoritative database for the state, FEMA, EPA, and the counties. And this is, we would help distribute that through the cloud infrastructure to all the response partners so that everybody was reporting out at the same time. The other big thing that we implemented that we are implementing right now too for the current fires is the data-driven status. So we came up with an internal status as well as a public status based on conditions of what the data was being collected. So you no longer had field teams going out and deciding, you know, what the status was just based on a drop-down. The data was driving the status so that we had consistent reporting there, which was one of the main, for lack of a better word, drivers of the response, but it really helped us with our quality of data as well as our reporting to the public in a consistent manner. There were operational QAQCs that were done. We had in the field a perimeter survey where the teams would go out with their paper form, and just do a perimeter survey and see if there were any HHWs or asbestos-containing materials left. And then those results, you know, just from a perimeter, they were followed on as the teams were going. And if any of those results, we would QC them against the initial assessments. We also had a full-blown site reassessment for from a statistical standpoint, I think it was maybe 15% of the properties that were chosen to go back out and do a reassessment. And then that was using a mobile form, and then that was able to be QA-QC'd very quickly to basically say, you know, if we are on target operationally of what we're doing out there and if our SOPs, our operational SOPs are good, and we were able to QC that using the database architecture there. We also had data QAQC procedures that were daily checks. So as teams were submitting in real time, we were running consistently QAQC checks of if we answered yes, that there was asbestos-containing material on the property, but no, we didn't collect any, well, that's a red flag. So let's see what, you know, maybe something wasn't filled out correctly. And so this was a consistent, you know, 24-hour process of any data issues that, you know, would relate to then field operational issues. And we would go back to logbooks. We would contact the field team members right away for any of the red flags that were set out by the categories that we thought were, you know, good checks based on the data quality objectives. And that allowed us to release the data to the public fairly quickly. You know, within, like I said before, if we got it out in 2 days, that would be great. Now we were releasing it, you know, out within, you know, 12 hours so that at the midnight pool, everybody could get that data and that information. And so the results of it, it really allowed us to have a higher level of confidence in our data, as well as identify if we needed to do any retraining for our operational SOPs. So the data QC and the operational QC really helped us keep, you know, consistently moving the ball forward on the operational QA QC or the operational SOPs, as well as the just-in-time trainings that we were doing. The use of the platform and being able to do everything within these what we call SDE databases, relational databases, as well as using ArcGIS Online, EPA Geo Platform was the key collaborator of these responses. Is that we were able to transition everything that the EPA did within the phase one of the HHW assessment very quickly to DTSE for the next phase contractor through ArcGIS Online, as well as for the extra server that we got added on, we were able to decommission that dedicated fire server very quickly and move it to the legacy server because of the data standards that followed the data quality objectives and the standard schemas and data collection tools and reporting tools that we use consistently throughout the response. One of the big, Gene, if you could play this video, one of the big wins for the EPA was the use of the story maps to brief the public. And I believe on the posted slides, you'll have a video to kind of take you through those. But the story maps enabled the public to see what was happening during the responses in real time and where their property was in the process. So pushing forward to 2020, there are operational differences that are happening in Oregon and in Northern California right now from 2020, but the consistent data approach is allowing us to use the same model. And we're able to adapt those data-driven statuses right now. Which is great. So it created a base model now to expand that out. And like I said before, there are additional forms for new operations, and then we're using the new format of the story maps so that it's scalable. Before we were just reporting for Butte County, now we're reporting for, I believe, 4 different counties in California and maybe 8 different counties in Oregon right now. So it's been adaptable to multiple regions to collect and report data in the same way using the same infrastructure and architecture. And also within the posted slides there, we have, this is the 2020 story map application that we're using where we are able to show Santa Cruz data and San Mateo data and Monterey data all at the same time. So with that, my slide with everybody's name on it is not coming up. So with that, I'd like to thank, you know, this was a coordinated effort between the EPA and the EPA Region 9 geospatial technical team there, ERT within EPA there, and then the Weston technical support team and DTSE. You know, it was a big coordinated event to really make this happen from a GIS and data management side. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Janine. All right, we're going to move into our final speaker. This is Mr. Chuck Wisman. He is a senior principal of GeoSynTech Consultants with over 25 years' experience supporting clients on over 450 challenging remediation projects across the world. He's long supported client managers, technical organizations, and government agencies to develop effective and innovative technical solutions to challenging remediation projects. He's assisted many clients, oil and gas clients, with the development of remediation guidance and engineering design standards. He's developed processes for making the right in-situ remediation technology decisions and created remediation system optimization tools and guidance. He's developed patented chemical ox, chemox processes such as ozone and hydrogen peroxide injection techniques, real-time feasibility study mobile platforms, and involves remote monitoring and optimization tools in most of his remediation designs. He earned his BS in civil and environmental engineering from University of Pittsburgh and is a Pennsylvania licensed PE. Chuck, take it away.
Great. Thanks, Eric. It's my pleasure to be here to discuss some recent LMAPL remediation sites where innovative remediation strategies were developed with the involvement of many key stakeholders to really drive success at the projects. So the first case study I wanted to get into is a brownfields redevelopment site at a resort complex in the Caribbean. Assessment and design work was done in 2017 and 2018. Then at the beginning of last year, started construction of the remediation system in January, started the system in March. And this is a former industrial facility where there was a pretty large diesel plume. Where you see the building here that's showing a industrial building where there was a release in pipelines serving diesel to a couple generators and backup generators as well as to the boiler. And the diesel plume extended towards this property boundary over here and on the other side and around the building and underneath the building. So a lot of challenges, and we wanted to move fast to keep up with the developer's schedule. The stakeholders included regulators, government officials, the resorts, as well as the developers and investors. So this is an overview of the aerial map showing the plume, the extent of the plume. I'd say about 4 acres of the plume was over half a foot of oil and up to 3 feet of oil in the center and underneath the building. So, some of that area where the oil was underneath the buildings and then extended on different directions outward from the buildings. What you see on the right here, this photograph, is one of the things we did was in the beginning of last year, we installed recovery trenches. And these were about 12 feet deep, 12 to 14 feet deep, 5 to 6 feet wide, over 200 feet in length. There was 4 large recovery trenches like this. And about 5 to 6 feet below grade, what you see there is that's diesel oil on the water table. So that's about a half foot of diesel. Now, the nice thing about working in this eolitic limestone is the sidewalls stay open, and it's not often that you get to see a cross-section of the subsurface as you do remediation like we had at the site. Here's another aerial view. And basically, this is a site plan showing the monitoring and recovery wells in red, the air sparge points in blue, trenches across the site. We did an LNAPL risk and mobility analysis was performed to really develop site-specific cleanup goals for not just the LNAPL, but groundwater and soil. And again, that was for residential future potential use in case the developers ever developed a residential or hotel type purpose out here. We had recovery wells inside the building. We had the recovery trenches outside as well. What you see in those lines, this is one recovery trench here, another one here, another long one on this side of the building, and another long one over on this side. And we'll show more images of those as we go. But really, yesterday, some of the sessions talked about combined technologies, and we used a lot of different technologies out here to be extremely aggressive and try to remediate the entire plume to the standards that we developed in less than 6 months of operation. So we had groundwater and oil recovery, and that was from 16 recovery wells, as well as the 4 trenches where we had 8 different pumps in those trenches, and we used top-loading pneumatic pumps, as well as high-flow groundwater submersible pumps so that we can dewater and draw down the water table in those trenches and then allow more product to flow in. So we also use vapor extraction to treat the excavated soil. What you see there in the right of that photo is the yellow liner that's basically making the soil pile, the excavated soil, into a big burrito, where we used enhanced bioremediation and soil vapor extraction there. We used vacuum-enhanced oil and groundwater recovery, air sparging. We added surfactants to the sparge points. We also treated the water and reinjected the oxygenated water. So not only did air sparging get the dissolved oxygen up, but also the aerated treated water helped as well. And that really enhanced the bioremediation process in the subsurface. So a lot of technologies working together. Another big aspect of remediation success was the optimization tools that were designed into the system equipment and at the recovery trenches. There were transducers in the system container as well as in the field and in the trenches. So we were able to real-time monitor flow rates, pressures, water levels in the trenches and any tanks, and also use variable frequency drives to adjust the recovery rates and the pumping rates from the different trenches. And what you see in this display here in the photo is the user interface. That same display would come up as from the United States as I would optimize the system remotely. And these are just four different pages that you could look at and adjust. A lot of these different white boxes here are flow rates and pressures that are changing every second. So this is an oil-water separator flow in and out. This is one of two air compressors that were serving the pneumatic pumps as well as air sparging. And another cool aspect, you know, I mentioned the variable frequency drive. So this is a recovery trench. We had electrical submersible pumps and then the top loading oil and water pumps that would pump about 12 gallons per minute. These electrical pumps, we could click on this black box here and the variable frequency drive would let us change it from anywhere from 0 to 200 gallons per minute. Right now it's saying 40 some gallons per minute. You could change the frequency going to the pump and change that to 150 gallons per minute, and you'd watch the water levels change. You could also set these pumps to turn on and off at certain elevations. So just some of the innovative controls. This shows the reinjection trench where we sent the treated water into. You can see, you know, the flow rate coming from the pneumatic pumps from any of the trenches when those pumps over here would cycle on. And every day we were getting, you know, data to optimize the process. We also had real-time cameras to see how things were going at the site and monitor everything inside the equipment as well as outside. This photo here is the oil-water separator in the oil-water separation room. We can see, you know, contractors are pumping out the oil tanks. And again, we were monitoring things. Every day we were collecting a round of water level elevations to see how product thicknesses were changing. So basically, you know, some of the activities, the total fluids, oil and groundwater recovery from the different wells and trenches, the high flow water, we recovered over 20 million gallons of water and treated that water and reinjected it. The vacuum enhanced recovery really helped to pull more oil into recovery pumps, and I have a slide that shows and depicts some of that. And we had over 4,000 gallons of oil that was covered in three phase. And hydrocarbons were treated in a lot of different ways, the SVE, the air sparging, the bioremediation, as well as the surfactant injection. And then this is a slide that shows that one observation well that was a recovery well, OW24. When we started the system, we had about almost 2 feet of oil thickness. So really quickly, the top loading pump pumping probably about 6 gallons per minute on average of water and products, got that thickness down significantly. It stabilized low. Then we started the air sparge system to direct, help have a pressure gradient towards wells. And we saw some spikes as we optimized that system. And then about here, as we get into May, this line here is when we start the application of a vacuum on this recovery well. So the vacuum helped to really not just treat hydrocarbons in the adsorb phase, but really pull in more oil. And what you can see here is, you know, immediately as we started that, we saw more oil coming into that recovery well. So it really enhanced what looked like you had stabilized how much oil you were coming into the bringing into the well. You know, maybe you were kind of at the limit of that technology and got as much out as you could get, but then the vacuum helped drive even more recovery. And then next, just wanted to show, you know, a visual that you could see at the site and how the success would operate here. So this, in the back foreground, is one of the air sparge points. And then what we're going to do is we're going to look about 30 feet from that air sparge point. This is the aeration that we're getting and the pressure gradient we're getting into a trench. And this was collected, you know, towards the end of the remediation. When we first started the air sparging system, the recovery trenches had already gotten a lot of the oil out, and it helped to really push the remaining small amounts of oil that were still out there, pushed it towards that trench for recovery, and then started to attack the adsorbed and dissolved phase hydrocarbons. So these slides go from the top left across the top, and that's from March of last year into April. And then at the bottom, you can see that it goes from May through May and into July. And by the end of it, by the middle of the summer, we just didn't see any NAPL anywhere out there anymore and met the cleanup standards and performed our post-remediation sampling. So really, it was 5 months of very aggressive remediation for a very large oil plume. Worked closely with the regulators to not just develop the game plan for cleanup goals, but for everything else out here and to get the no further action status. And I think there's a visual that shows, you know, just over time, when you collect product thicknesses every day, you can come out with an image like this. And what this is showing, you know, this is when the remediation system started. We started to pump a lot in, then we started to do the sparging, then we started another pulse there is when we started to do the vacuum enhanced extraction soon when we get into May. And, you know, it looks like an amoeba growing and shrinking, but overall it's just showing the optimization that we were doing. As it would clean up in certain parts of the site, we'd just more aggressively attack it in some of those other areas until we got to the end of it where really there was no more measurable product at any well or trench out there. And that animation that you just saw was just really going over the 5 months of the using the many technologies to be aggressive to get the cleanup levels. And the next site, this is a pretty large power and industrial complex in the Caribbean. And this is an area that for many decades, there was a very massive oil plume that was migrating into the ocean. So that's a big aerial view in the background. And then in the bottom right here, you see the oil as it was coming out of the limestone caverns and voids. That's a boom that someone had put in place that wasn't really working too well. And they really were struggling, and it was getting worse and worse over the years. So pretty massive project. There's some more photos of, you know, some temporary brooms that people were trying to use to capture it and try to recover it. In some cases, this made it worse because it would have the oil kind of go over the boom in large masses and wash up on beaches half mile away or impact ships or divers or other businesses locally. So, you know, some pretty challenging project. What we came up with was three lines of defense for this. So this was a steel sheet pile by wall that was put in place. So first and foremost, wanted to stop the migration of the oil into the ocean. So this is a steel sheet pile wall. And if you look at the engineering drawing over here, this is the rock outface where the oil was migrating from. We have three lines of defense. The first is like a French drain system that would capture the oil, and you could recover oil from it. On the back wall of that French drain system was a liner that was put in. And then finally, the steel sheet pile wall. This is the ocean floor, and half of the wall and the steel sheet piles were driven beneath the ocean floor. So about 20 feet to the ocean floor and almost another 20 feet to get to the bottom of that. And it was tied back into the rock face. So So pretty good geotechnical aspects to make it sturdy for storm conditions as well. This shows the barrier wall when we were about 60% complete. This is showing, you know, the outfall discharge of one of the oil seeps. There were many more along here, and as we got the barrier wall put in, those seeps went away. So we were about 60% done here. As we finished it off and came all the way down here, there were no more seeps into the ocean. So that was the first step, and then, you know, future work is to recover oil in the plume area itself. So a couple cross sections, you know, again, that's that French drain system. That's looking into that about 4-foot diameter sump. Here's the sump in both directions is that French drain. It goes about 180 feet in each direction. So any oil that migrates towards this, the fluctuation of the oil is typically in this range here, and it could be recovered in this trench with pumps. We ran pipes to it and so forth. And those are some construction drawings showing how we put it in. You can also see the liner on the back wall that was dropped in that deep excavation there. And here are some more construction photos. There was a large concrete cap put on top as well. And the beautiful thing is that by the time we were done, you could, again, now finally look down, not see oil, not see turbidity, but see clear down to the ocean floor for 20 feet and see all the marine life and no more oil getting out. So, you know, a lot of different stakeholders involved in this project. And it was, you know, geotechnical challenge too, because there was a lot of storm action out here. Hurricane Dorian hit this area pretty aggressively last year. And there's just a video here, Gene, if you can cue it up, that shows, you know, that wave action and the storm from Dorian and how it held up fine because it was designed for these type of conditions. So again, this is the completed wall and concrete on top here. And here's the video playing. You can see the wave action. So a couple things are happening here, you know, during hurricane, during the sea level and storm surge was very high. And then the waves were very impactful. But the wall was designed for this force. And this is a pretty powerful sea surge and force out here. And it, you know, held up fine and did a great job. And there were no problems from, you know, the storm and the impact of the storm. It was designed really to weather that situation and some of those waves. So just wanted to, you know, show those examples. And again, a lot of stakeholders involved. Here's the final barrier wall. You see no more oil seeping out of there. Ministry of Environment, Ministry of Works, the regional industrial facilities, government leaders all came together because of the importance to stop this decades-long issue and problem. There's also a good video that's available that maybe we can share with people that, you know, shows the different stakeholders together and how the local businesses helped as well, and they were very happy with the final solution. And then finally, just wanted to talk about some other advances in LNAP remediation. You know, a lot of different enhanced land farm type situations. This top image is more the biocell, enhanced biocell, that burrito system I talked about before. Could enhance it with SVE. I've also had situations where you use ozone injection or other amendments to enhance that treatment of that soil. And then down below, more of an enhanced land farm. This is a situation that system that's being installed right now where we're actually getting the drainage off of there, treating it, recirculating it with highly oxygenated water and doing other enhancements, aerating it and moving air through it. And here's an example of that system that's being constructed right now. This is actually to treat over 40,000 cubic yards of material that was oil impact from a hurricane in soil, as well as debris and trees that were oil impacted that were mulched up to really help with the bioprocess and treat that material as well. And that was more of a crude oil impact. So this is the liner at the bottom of the landform, soil and the mulch is just getting put onto it, and then a retention pond down here where we're going to recirculate things. We're going to collect the drainage. We're going to put SVE laterals here, and it's really going to be a nice enhanced landform system, and, you know, having hot temperatures in the Caribbean environment helps it as well. And then finally, you know, other technologies just wanted to talk about briefly was the STAR smoldering technology, which, you know, we're seeing used a lot on international crude oil remediation projects, both using this technology in situ, in the ground, even below the water table, and you don't need supplemental fuel. You add the air and the oxygen source and get it to smolder like a campfire and treat the material without a supplemental fuel source. So this is the in-situ process, and then seeing a lot of opportunities and projects where we're using it for ex-situ on what we call the hot pad system. And here's just the slide that shows crude oil impact in a pond, scooping that out, mixing it into a sand material, and then getting it up to temperature, smoldering it, and having it look like a clean, pristine material, getting even the high hydrocarbon chains down to non-detect. And you can see from these images at the top, you know, pretty significant difference from, you know, that heavily stained black, tarry-like material to very pristine soil with non-detects for hydrocarbons. So some pretty interesting aspects there. And just to wrap it up in summary, you know, all these projects I talked about had some pretty interesting stakeholder and regulatory engagement. People worked together as a team. We got everybody's feedback real time. It expedited approvals, helped us optimize things, everything involved, and also did transfer of knowledge to people locally in some of these other countries, which is an important aspect, you know, some ways that we can really give back. We designed it for optimization and flexibility and did real-time monitoring to help with that optimization process. So with that, I appreciate the time, and this was a great opportunity. So thank you, everyone.
All right, Chuck, thanks very much. That was a really nice presentation, and I think the images of the blue water, the warm temps, is ringing with us in the Northeast where it's winter's on its way. So thanks very much for all that. So we got a few minutes for some questions. We did get a few coming in during the talk. I'm going to kind of bounce around a little bit here, but we had one for Janine. Let me find this question for you. You touched on this a little bit, but there's a question that came in about, you know, what do you feel is the most important lesson that you all learned from your 2018 and 2019 work that was applied to the obviously crazy 2020 fire season?
Sorry, I can't.
Janine,
and I was me. I had myself muted. Definitely the data-driven statuses and how we're applying them this year with our additional operations. We have a recon effort going on as well as a more robust QA/QC effort going on, and being able to tie those into the operational statuses as well as the public-facing statuses of the parcels has really been one of the bigger lesson learned and application from what we did in 2017 to 2018 to now.
Eric, I think you need to unmute.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, thank you, because that was, the 2020 season has been pretty bad. I mean, we've been seeing great sunsets on the East Coast from the smoke plumes coming over, so it's obviously a pretty aggressive fire season. Great. Chuck, there's a question for you. Had your team considered any sort of aggressive thermal remediation strategy at the NAPL recovery site?
Yeah, we did. We looked at all technologies, and we looked at cost-benefit analysis and life cycle costs. And the approach that was put together was the most cost-effective approach that we could come up with in that six-month period.
Okay. Yeah, on that note, another question about how was the supply chain for materials and equipment an issue working in the Caribbean?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And what we did, I meant to mention it, that shipping container, part of the green remediation aspect of what we were doing out there was we used an old refurbished shipping container, built the system in the United States, and shipped things to the site because it's very hard to get materials, especially, you know, a lot of specialty transducers and so forth. So we did things as much as we could plug and play. So build it so that when we got to the site, used a lot of above grade piping and did plug and play as much as possible. Now, locally, you can find, you know, good resources for labors, for concrete, for construction, but on the specialty remediation equipment, that's a good question. You know, build it and then ship it so that it's plug and play. C-Box is easy to ship over.
Yeah, okay, very good. Yeah, thank you. Here's a question for Tim. Question about the existing photos that you have. Can the existing photos be tied into the ArcGIS system, or do they need to be tied into a survey grid, or, you know, kind of woven in and integrated spatially?
Sure. Yeah. So any historic imagery that you have can be georeferenced within desktop GIS. And that was actually a key workflow for this project. We georeferenced over a dozen historic aerial images as far back as 1940 to present day, and included them in an ArcGIS Online web viewer so that you could slide through through time and look at changes in the site over time. So absolutely.
Okay, very nice. Another question about the, I think this is the chemical analysis, and how accurate is the field high-res data from the chemical analysis, from a chemical analysis perspective, maybe with, in comparison to a lab run sample?
So the resolution, I'm taking that to mean like positional accuracy, GPS type accuracy. We are using centimeter grade RTK GPS to capture real-time precisions on the order of 1 to 2 centimeters vertically and horizontally. It's nearly survey grade equipment.
Okay. You cited a LIDAR accuracy of about, I think it was 10 centimeters on that. Is that vertical or horizontal? And does that have to do with it being mounted on the drone? Or is that a LIDAR technical spec?
Sure. Yeah, so that plus or minus 10 centimeters is the final product, the derivative digital elevation model product. There is, because we're collecting so much data, there's a bit of fuzziness in which point actually represents true ground surface, because it's also capturing things like blades of grass and going through the grass and getting the soil. So you do need to do some cleanup and interpretation, but we are also referencing into surveyed benchmarks to establish ground control. So it's as precise horizontally as it can be, and then we are using data reduction and post-processing techniques to get the Z value as precise as possible.
Okay, thank you. Early on, we had a couple, while you were speaking, Tim, we had a few questions come in regarding the use of drones as Superfund sites, and I think a few came in, and I think this is probably a question for EPA. But has there been, the gist of the series of questions was, has there been any sort of work done in terms of policy development for use of drones for survey at Superfund sites? And
so
I'm going to direct that more towards Kate. Thank you.
Yeah, so this is Kate Garufi from EPA, and we appreciate all the questions on drones. I know it's been always a constant question of, can we use drones at EPA? And Gene and I, during your presentations, are scrambling around to find out the answer to that. So one of the things that I wanted to mention was in previous fiscal years before 2020, typically drones were not used by EPA for CERCLA projects. In 2020, the Further Consolidated Appropriations Act came out that authorized the use of drones under CERCLA and Oil Pollution Act responses. So the way things are working right now is EPA, per acts like that, have to develop agency-wide policy as well as
procedures for specific programs like Superfund remedial and removal. So EPA is in the process right now of developing Superfund-specific procedures under a EPA-wide policy that I believe is also under development. Per our interim SOPs, the regions can consult with headquarters and get approval on a site-by-site basis to use them. So the restrictions on using them at EPA sites is lessened and will be more widespread in the future thanks to that act and the specific use at CERCLA sites. So I think that's a positive. And an answer I didn't know before someone asked that question. So thank you for making me research it.
Excellent. All right, thank you, Kate.
Yeah, and Eric, that spurred a thought for me too. You know, one thing I'd like to call out is a lot of projects internationally, it's amazing how many times we revert back to EPA standards, policies, guidance to help other regulators in other countries understand, you know, what is a good way to do things or how can we develop a site-specific cleanup goal where they might not have any cleanup goals. You know, I mentioned LNAPL risk and mobility analysis. You know, we use the EPA guidance to drive that and help the local regulatory and government community with those procedures that were put in place by EPA years ago.
Very good. Yeah. Well, I think we're getting close to the 7 o'clock Eastern time. I want to thank all three of the panelists and everyone for posing questions, and this has been a very great discussion, and I'm thankful I got the opportunity as well to moderate the panel, and thank you guys for doing a great job. So with that, I'm going to send it back to Kate to wrap it up.
And thank you, Eric, and I want to echo the thanks to the panel. Janine, Tim, and Chuck, you guys did a great job. You know, a lot of information. I think modern technologies to both make things more cost-effective, efficient, and in a lot of ways increase communication and make people more safe. So I appreciate that. I learned a lot personally, so thank you. In closing, I wanted to wrap up today. This is day 2 of 3. So we have another day tomorrow. Before I go over briefly the agenda for tomorrow, I'd again like to thank our event sponsors, Northwind, Sevenson Environmental Services, Hydrogeologic, Leidos, TRS Group, Geosyntech Consultants, AECOM, Black & Veatch, CDM Smith, EA Engineering Science and Technology, Weston Solutions, FRX, Vista Geoscience, HDR, Groundwater Treatment and Technology, and Cero Solutions and Eagle Synergistic. I want to direct everybody to our website for the DCHWS events. It's www.dchws.org. There you can find out more information about our event sponsors as well as information about future events that I'm going to go over in a slide after this. So tomorrow we wrap up the symposium event. We're switching gears a little bit and talking about a variety of different sites, groundwater, sediment, residential cleanup sites, talking first about overcoming challenges in urban high-access settings, and then closing it out with planning for success, and I think planning something we've heard about in all our panels so far, so some RDRA case studies and lessons learned. So I encourage you to join tomorrow. In closing, again, I would like to thank our panelists today. And I would like to direct you all to some future events that we have planned. In March 29th through 31st, 2021, we are planning an in-person symposium in Philadelphia. It's similar to the previous symposiums that we've done. After this event, we'll be sending out a call for abstracts. Similar format, 20-minute presentations followed by facilitated Q&A. So if you're interested in participating in a future in-person event, I highly encourage you to submit an abstract. Likewise, we have some longer, every other month, two-hour webinars that we do on the same platform, and I have a call for abstracts out now for that. So if you're also interested, you can send me an email. My contact information is on CLUIN, as well as just send me an abstract, and we can go from there. So with that, I'd like to thank you for the great questions and your participation today. And I'm going to turn it over to Jean for some final closing remarks. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much, Kate. I'll keep this short and sweet. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation content, we have that posted already on the seminar homepage. You would have seen that when you were checking in today. It's available right now on the right side of your screen. Again, those links can be accessed from this point on, so feel free to download the materials and reference it at any time. I will ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form. I often get asked for participation certificates, and if you would like one, you will get one when you submit feedback for today's session. So please be sure to fill out that online feedback form, checking the box at the bottom that you are here for the whole thing, and then you'll immediately have access to one of these certificates. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's sessions, you can still click on those links, access the feedback form, and send in feedback based off of your replay. And as I just hinted at, this session was recorded like the others in the series, so you'll automatically receive an email as soon as the archive is available to play on back on demand. So with that, I want to echo the thanks one more time to all of our presenters.